Today's sponsor is Audible. Please visit audiblepodcast.com/baldmove for a free audiobook download. Welcome to the Game of Thrones podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Game of Thrones on HBO. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're covering Season 6, Episode 1, titled The Red Woman. This was, I want to say, a controversial episode, and I was not surprised one bit by that.
Well, I mean, we knew this kind of coming in, that
yeah.
I'm expecting a lot of the book readers to be, especially in the first few episodes, because all they've talked about on the off-season, because I'm subscribed to a lot of them and check out the forums, is, you know, people not wanting to watch it and saying how it's going to go off the rails. And, mm-hmm. you know, they're like, I feel like there's a certain segment of the book readers who are predisposed to anything that not only, I mean, you're not even talking about deviations from the canon. You're talking about deviations from your predictions based on the canon.
Right.
And that is like this weird choose your own adventure where, you know, you chose wrong, bitch, sometimes. And I think people are going to have a problem with that.
Yeah, it's confirmation bias.
It's natural.
At its best. And it is completely natural. It's unfortunate, I think, because I don't think this was a bad episode. But a lot of people are like, oh, fuck this. There's so many plot holes and all this stuff. And we'll talk about that when we get to those scenes. But
it's also like, you
overall,
know,
the opinion, like I said in the preview cast, has come across as negative to me. The vast majority of the voices out there are saying this is bullshit.
I don't know, because I thought that like within a few hours of the meltdown thread that they posted on the Song of Ice and Fire forums, there was another one like, does anyone else think that this was a pretty good episode? And then there was...
But the most talk I see about it is, look at this plot hole,
yeah.
Look at their choices, and it's not a positive overall thing.
Yeah, well, I think it's like, you know, what do they always say, like, before you mess with psychedelics, it's all about set and setting, if you're going to have a good time or a bad time. Like, I went into the season with the mindset of, I am curious about what popular theories are going to be proven or disproven, because I think the Double D's are honest fans of Game of Thrones.
Sure.
And they are trying to do their level best to adapt this thing into a series of 10-hour seasons. So I don't think that when they're fucking with Dorne, they're doing it just because they don't like Dorne and think they know better than George. I think
let's not forget they have access. They have the most access to the man than anyone ever has.
Yeah.
So if anybody knows, it's them.
And I could see like circumstance, because like the big question is, why do you even hire who's the guy who plays Julian Bashir?
Andrew Sittig.
Yeah. Why do you hire a guy like that, who is well-known for genre work and for being good and professional, if you're going to do this to him? Because it does seem like this is a plot that could have been streamlined a lot. And I almost wonder, like, if this is a thing where George is like...
It's Alex Sittig, by the way.
Alex Sittig.
Sittig, whatever.
If he's like, you know, put a pin in it, and he was trying to drag his feet as long as possible to avoid committing to something. Because, like, I mean... If Prince Doran doesn't die, or this kind of Dornish plotline doesn't go similar, like, I guess I would be more outraged, but I don't have the book, so I'm assuming that some of this stuff was just red herrings that, that, you know, we talked about that, how I think George is trying to set this out, like, if World War II, if you're in the middle of World War II, it's not immediately obvious what are the critical things happening right now.
Sure. Like, you have other things on your mind.
Sure, like there's this big plot right now that Hitler's going to get blown up at a conference center.
Uh-huh.
That's huge, but it fails, so it becomes like a footnote in history.
And like, a Tom Cruise movie.
Yes, it winds up into a Tom Cruise movie. Your Scientology money at work. But you know what I'm saying? Like,
right.
I think with this, his gardener storytelling type and the fact that he's telling this sprawling political intrigue that... realistically, you would have a few dead ends that don't go anywhere. Now, is that great storytelling? Is that immersive storytelling? I think reasonable people can disagree.
Sure.
And also, you got to give people their initial emotional reactions to, like, I thought this was going to happen. This is my favorite character. He's behaving in ways I don't think is right.
Uh-huh.
But as a book reader, I found it kind of several scenes actually thrilling that we'll probably talk more about on the spoiler cast out Friday. Mm-hmm. You know, just a reminder, this is a spoiler-free television or podcast show, a podcast on the television show.
Yep.
So don't worry. The Friday cast is the one that you got to worry about.
General feelings aside, yeah, like of the audience, how did this episode hit for you?
I thought it was better even the second time. Okay. And I guess I didn't, a lot of the things that people are saying as plot holes, didn't bother me. And that's the thing. Right. Like, we've talked about this on a lot of other podcasts. There's this threshold of suspension of disbelief where it's naturally higher if you're liking what you're seeing on the screen. It's naturally lower when you're disliking, and things that could be, you know, whether it's a nitpick or a ground, you know, a plot breaking hole is kind of where you are in that set and setting. Like, what's your mindset going in, and how are you viewing this stuff? Are you just taking it as it is? It's like, well, this is new information, or do you have like built in bias and prejudices? I don't know. And, you know, I could see also that I feel like the other thing is this is a short episode. I mean, you had 50 minutes with 4 minutes of previously ons.
Right. It was a long previously
on. And people have been waiting a year for more Game of Thrones, and this is essentially a setup for the next episode. Next episode comes out and it's rocking, then maybe a lot of all this negativity goes away.
Yeah, I'm hoping that by the time that this season gets finds its legs, people will start to forget about these smaller things. I mean, I think it's inevitable.
Yeah.
But also, like, the tone will have switched to, we're back on board with Game of Thrones. I don't think that's going to happen. I think the book readers are just going to be pissed until the book comes out. You know, and I lump book readers all together. I'm sorry for that. I'm generalizing here.
Yeah, yeah.
But the vast majority of the tone I saw was negative. I didn't think this was an amazing episode. Uh-huh. You know, it's not the Battle of Blackwater. It's not anything like that. But as far as, like, I heard a lot of people saying Game of Thrones last season had a really kind of epic end mm-hmm. to the season. Mm-hmm. The season finale was bigger than it usually is.
Mm-hmm.
And this episode kind of feels like what a season finale would have been in previous seasons of Game of Thrones.
Oh, you're right.
Kind of setting up the next pieces of the puzzle.
You're right.
And moving us along to what stories the season premiere would have told.
Yeah.
But we're not there yet, so we have to do that a little bit.
Well, and I feel like the Double D's are trying to adapt to criticism, because I think they've, you know, it's been a popular thing to say that instead of trying to get to everything in a single episode, you should isolate on a few characters.
Hmm.
And then I think they've tried to do that, especially last year, where you'd have a couple where it's like, okay, now we're going to talk about this corner of the world. Next episode, we're going to talk about this corner, and we're going to abandon Bran entirely. And they got criticism for that, too. So it's like, if you want a show that, like, touches on everything, one, the price to pay for that is if you're going to set up a lot of epic things, it's going to take a lot of incremental movements over a whole bunch of scenes. And I guess I'm looking at this as, like, how is this setting up for next episode rather than I am not fulfilled by what's going on right now.
Right, right.
But, I mean, I guess I'm shocked that book readers are as angry as they were when, like, something as awesome as Melisandre taking her necklace off and getting old happened.
Yeah.
Like, that's, I think that's super cool, and that should, I'm surprised that it hasn't, like, really, like, had book readers discussing that more than why didn't the dogs attack, and how did the person possibly get on a ship, and,
uh-huh.
And, you know, I'm using my, oh, I'm an idiot voice. I'm not trying to say that. That's just, you know, that's how I roll.
Right.
But yeah, I'm gonna try to answer some of these objections.
Okay. Yeah, I do not want this podcast to dwell on those, because if you want that shit, go to /rGameOfThrones.
Holy shit, yes.
It's full of that stuff.
I saw a thread that this is my breaker, because, you know, you got the circle jerk in Reddit where it's like someone posts, this might be a controversial opinion, and then the first word is the response post is exactly. And then it's like, I saw a chain that had like eight exactlies in a row. Like, they were just exactly. It's like it's like watching a snake eat its own tail. Wow. I mean, yeah, there's places to go to if you really hate this episode and you want to wallow and revel in the plot holes and the destruction of this series and how it's obviously going to be a failure.
Sure.
Places you can go for that. This is going to be a little bit more upbeat. Now, I reserve my right to flip my shit later.
All right.
You know, like, the table's still set. I could flip it any time. I'm just saying, this is not...
You got all the nice china out. Sure. You got the crystalware.
Sure. Yeah.
You got it all just set up.
Yep. But I'm not quite there yet.
Okay. Well, let's get into the recap and see if we can get you there. We jump back in where we left off with Jon Snow.
Oh, wait. Before we do, I want to talk about ratings. Yep.
Oh, okay.
Joe M. from Philly sent us in some information about this. Set records for the show. 10.7 million total viewers on Sunday alone.
Jesus.
8 million watched the show live at 9 p.m. on Sunday. The other 2.7 million are combined total for two Sunday night encores and HBO Go and HBO Now streams.
That's me. Well, it was kind of me.
Yeah.
I had some trouble with it. But
well, here's the thing. Like, our server... We last week doubled our server capacity because we knew that the hordes were coming, and it still, like, when it came time to for 50,000 people to jump on our feeds, it was like, and it completely melted. But HBO Go has that thing too. Like, a lot of times the first season, the episode or two will have some streaming issues.
Well, it wasn't even like, oh, it's just overloaded or whatever. It told me I was in the wrong country to view this.
Well,
it said
I
wasn't
other people...
in the United States. And I was like, motherfucker.
Yes.
I'm in the United States. Yes. My provider knows I am because guess what? I can't watch season two of Better Call Saul on Netflix.
Yeah.
So it's not my service
provider.
But I
think that's a symptom because other people said it was saying that it was locked out because of a time zone. So I think that that's like symptomatic
Their
of it just losing
just
its shit. Right,
yeah.
Right. Like, our server's parlance was 504 gateway error.
Right.
That's just the lies it tells you.
It just throws out any random error. You know what? Like, I don't even have the capacity to look up an error code at this point.
Yeah, right? I'll let your browser deal with that. But, you know,
that's a lot of people.
Yes, that's a lot of people. Compared,
for a premium network.
And that's not and including piracy. I saw that Torrent Freak were saying there's over a million people downloaded season six premiere in the first 24 hours.
Wow. Yeah.
And contrast that to season one, 2.2 million tuned in to the first episode of Game of Thrones.
Whoa. Big growth over the 5 years.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, that's the thing. Like, when we get the live plus 7 day, which is kind of like the thing for HBO, it wouldn't surprise me at the end of the season, unless it just completely craps to bed, that we're talking like not Game of Thrones. We're talking Watching Dead numbers.
Walking Dead numbers, yeah, even.
Walking Dead numbers. Watching Dead numbers are a lot more modest. Walking Dead numbers. And that on a premium cable show is insane.
Right. Everybody's paying for the privilege here.
HBO is shitting gold right now.
Seems like it, yeah.
So, yeah, apologies if that affected you, but again, it's like we tried to plan for a lot of growth, and we still didn't quite get it right, so.
Discover why critics are calling Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes the best film of the franchise.
What a wonderful day!
It's a jaw-dropping spectacle that demands to be seen on the biggest screen possible.
We need to go.
Hang on. It is our time.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Now playing only in theaters. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
Hey, real quickly, before we get into the recap, I just want to remind everybody about our club at club.baldmove.com. For shockingly little, as little as a buck a month, you can get access to a bunch of special features, including ad-free feeds. We're going to be doing the live playthrough of the final chapter of the Telltale Game of Thrones video game. If you want to get in on that, you got to be a club member. We might have a couple other surprises coming down the pike. But you also could have been watching us record this podcast live and gotten it hours early. Lots of cool features. Club.baldmove.com. Now we can talk about the show.
Okay. We start off right back with Jon Snow, where we left him in the snow.
After a real doozy of a previous yawn, again, 4 minutes.
Yeah, it was a long-ass one.
Yeah, like, I was like, that was the one thing that kind of got me excited, that they were going to really, you know, nail down a bunch of nails, because usually the longer the previous yawn, the more holy shit is going to happen in this episode.
So we hear ghost howling, which attracts the attention of some brothers, including Davos. They find Jon's body. They move it inside. This is essentially like everybody who wasn't participating in the killing.
Yes.
Right? Although it can't be, because some of the brothers in the meeting later, I'm not sure why everybody didn't hear this and run out. Maybe some were sleeping or lazy.
What do you mean? Not everybody heard that.
Only the quote unquote good guys. Only the guys who end up with with Davos in the chamber later.
Well, I thought the first guys, couple guys that showed up were not the John loyalists. It's just that once Ed guy shows up, Dolores Ed. Apparently, I'm pronouncing that wrong.
I have no idea.
What a twist! I took my ruby necklace off, and suddenly I can't pronounce anything.
We need a previously on for Aaron's
all the butchery of names. But Dolores Ed, let's just go with Dolores. When he shows up, I think that's when Davos like snatched on and like, we need to get this guy. We need to get him in the Lord Commander's quarters.
Okay. They take the body, they move it inside. Then Melisandre comes inside later and sees the body and looks slightly disappointed.
A couple things I want to point out here. Did you happen to notice the pattern of blood in the snow? Or if there even was one.
No, I mean, it just looked like a blood splotch to me.
Well, when I first saw it, I'm like, this looks like some kind of Rorschach shit, or this, there could be like a bird imagery in the middle of that. And the second time, and subsequent watches, I actually paused and looked at it a lot. I don't see anything there. I mean, Davos looks kind of shocked, but I think what they're trying to suggest is the quantity of blood that Jon Snow has lost. Like, Davos is like, oh, there's no way. Like, yeah. It's like all of his blood is out on the ground in a perfect Jon Snow body outline.
A blood angel, essentially.
Yeah. I don't think they intended to suggest that there was anything more to it. I saw some people wondering what I've made of that, but I didn't see anybody actually saying, oh, well, this is actually the sigil for House foreshadowing, and their words are, pay attention and you might be spoiled. I don't know. The other thing I wanted to talk about is, and this is, I think this is key for trying to figure out what's going on, the titular, no pun intended, Red Woman. She always made a big thing of not being cold at Castle Black.
Right.
But the Lord of the Light, the fire from within sustained her. She's wearing a heavy, heavy cloak coming into Jon's quarters here.
Okay.
Which I think is suggestive of her powers becoming weak or her spirit becoming low, because from her perspective, the Lord of the Lights, you know, delivered a couple solid kicks right to the cooch.
Mm-hmm.
Lied to her, maybe.
Yeah, fucked up the Stannis thing, fucked up the Jon Snow thing.
And I went, for another reason, which we'll talk about later, I went to go look at a season 4 scene where Selyse and her are talking and she's taking a bath, and she talked a lot about how lies sometimes lead people to the truth. And she was using it in the way of like, oh, these stupid men, I throw some stuff in the fire, and they're like, ooh, ah, they're Lord of Light.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought it's interesting that, you know, maybe your lord, or whatever this spiritual deity force of nature being is, maybe it is fucking with you the same way you fuck with other people.
Right.
So
some prophecies that she doesn't quite understand and
she's
thinks
misinterpreting,
she does.
Because that's the thing, like, you know, there's a couple questions. Does she actually see genuine prophecies in these fires? Like, that's an open question. Mm-hmm. Or is she just a crazy person that thinks she sees? If she does see things, is her interpretation guaranteed to be correct?
Sure.
So those are some things I was thinking about as I was watching this scene. And the fact that she saw him in the flames fighting at Winterfell seems to suggest that maybe she was hopeful that that John would lead the Black Brothers to some kind of crusade to save Stannis, which I know Stannis went to go ask for. So maybe, I don't know. That's all interesting things she's saying here.
Next scene, Alistair Thorne calls a meeting to tell the Black Brothers that he killed Jon Snow, and he proclaims that he did it because Jon would have destroyed the Night's Watch, and his first loyalty is obviously to the Night's Watch.
I continue to think this is pretty good.
Yeah, I mean,
as far as it goes, you know, like, I think of how offensive it would be if you spent thousands of years keeping these people out. When they do get over, they go and murder farmers, and they rape, and they pillage, and they burn crops, and now you're giving them that land. Like, this is essentially why, like, Palestine is such a hot issue. So much shit has come to pass that, like, for one side to be like, you know what, bygones, is extraordinarily tough for them to do. And I thought that, you know, I think Thorne is an asshole, but his speech was good, and it seemed like it did a lot to win over the majority of the Black Brothers.
Yeah, his justifications are understandable, both to me as an audience member, and I think to the people in the chamber there, his audience chamber. I understand. Look, some kid some royalty punk kid comes in and
bastard
takes
royalty.
Over. Right. Like, not even real royalty, but he's been spoiled and pampered his whole life. Yeah. Like, he comes up to the wall and he takes your position, or mm-hmm. what you would have had as your position
mm-hmm.
Had he not been there. And you get the anger. You understand it.
And then even, betrays even his commission.
Right. And then in your eyes, yeah. Just totally betrays his vows, betrays everything.
It's like multiple levels of what the hell.
Yeah.
Professionally, personally, it's
so
all...
I get where he's coming from. I don't like the decision. I think it's a shitty thing to do, but...
Yeah, but I understand. Framing it as, like, this is something that Jon Snow either forced us into a position of allowing the Brotherhood to be destroyed
yep.
by violation of our core mission, or disobeying the Lord Commander and being a traitor. It's like, in an impossible position, I love the Night's Watch, so I'm going to save the Night's Watch.
Right.
Again, self-serving and all that, but I thought it was pretty good. Because he has a tough road to hoe here.
Absolutely.
You know, loyalty is the foundation of our order. We just right. all of us, the first builder and the first steward and the first ranger all just murdered the mm-hmm. Lord Commander.
Right.
But you guys don't do that.
Yeah, you know? and we're not going to do it to you.
Yeah, sure.
Because we're loyal.
Right.
What?
Yeah,
what?
No.
So he's speaking out of both sides of his mouth here, but I understand why.
I think he's basically saying, like, if you guys want to come kill us, you better have a justification as good as mine.
Okay.
Like, what am I doing right. that's betraying the Night's Watch? Other than, yes, of course, killing the Lord Commander. But setting that aside, no,
there's
it's...
nothing in the vows about that, right?
Nah, there's nothing about not killing the Lord Commander. Not specifically.
not to the letter.
Sir Halster, the original rules lawyer.
Yeah.
There's no oath about not killing the Lord Commander.
So the brothers in the room with Jon decide that they need to fight for Jon's vengeance here. Davos agrees, but he knows, look, there's no way we can win this. Even with Direwolf, not going to happen. So he sends Ed off to find, quote-unquote, the other people who owe their lives to Jon Snow.
Which
there are others who owe their lives to this guy.
And the obvious one is the Wildlings, which seems like everyone's.
Seems like it.
And, you know, the line that he had about, if you were planning on seeing tomorrow, you picked the wrong room. I thought that was good. And I liked Ed's being just like, you know, I don't give a shit. Like, Jon is my friend. I'm probably going to die. I'm going to take these back. I'm going to die if I sit here in his room. I want to take as many of these bastards out as I can with me.
Mm-hmm.
I like that. I like the it shows. I don't think the show has always done a great job of building the relationships between Jon and some of the other friends he had very closely, other than like Sam.
Yeah.
But this does a lot to kind of just in a few lines of dialogue in this guy's performance to kind of sell that these people, like Jon was beloved by these men
yeah.
and they will die to protect, you know, not only his life, but essentially his memory and his honor.
Yeah. And I'll be honest. I don't remember much of the early seasons, between these guys and Jon Snow.
There wasn't a lot.
Right. Wasn't a ton of it.
Sure.
But what there was, I don't remember, but it didn't feel like a cheat or a shortcut or anything. It felt to me like that was right for some reason.
And now that they killed so many of the others that you would recognize, like Ed's, all the other guys who, like the men in this room that they can trust, I don't know any of those guys.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's like the one Ed guy that I know because I've read the books, and he's like a funny wise-ass character, and all these other randos.
Yeah.
But
pretty sure one of them fucks potatoes. So moving on, Ramsay eulogizes over Miranda's body. Then he tells a servant to feed her meat to the dogs. It's interesting to me. This is essentially, in its tone and its promises, the same scene as Jaime and Cersei later
sure.
on.
Except for one of them's alive, yeah.
Right, right.
Of them are alive, rather.
In the things that they proclaim to do,
yes.
right? I mean, Ramsay here is saying, I'm going to make everyone pay. I wish you were going to be here to see it. Jaime later on is saying, we're going to take back everything and more. You know, essentially, they're both going on revenge here. What parallels are we supposed to be drawing between these two guys?
I don't know
it other than just literally the speech they give.
Here's thematically, every time someone swears some fancy vow to do something, like the very first one I can think of is Khal Drogo.
Oh, God.
Like when he gets up and like, I'm going to take my Khalsar and I'm going to go across the Poison Sea and I'm going to fuck Westeros. And the next scene is he's on a, you know, funeral pyre getting burnt up.
Right.
Like there's not a great track record for people swearing these love vengeance vows.
Uh-huh.
And maybe that's what we're supposed to take away, that these are, you know, words are wind.
I could totally buy that because the next scene is, you know, Roose like
Before you move on, though, I want to ask you...
I want to talk thematically real quick about that.
Yeah.
Because in that next scene, they talk about, like, Rhys saying, oh, you've played your games. You played your game with Sansa. You've played your games with these armies. And games aren't going to get the job done. Like, that's not what we need here. And you're so busy, you're so focused on your sadism that you're getting lost in that.
Yeah.
And do you think this is going to be Ramsay's downfall, is just how sadistic he is?
Yes.
Okay.
I mean, this is the question
I agree.
I like to ask in the spoiler section is, what is Martin playing at? Like,
okay,
if he's telling a traditional heroic tale, but with a lot darker, more realism, then of course, if he's telling a bleaker and darker tale than I'm expecting him to, then I don't know, maybe the Boltons win and his sadism isn't his downfall. But no, I do feel like that you could probably shit on some of the people some of the time, but you can't all the people all the time. And the fact that he's had these big chips in his pile for this long, he's had the heir to the Iron Island, which I thought is interesting that they made a big deal of saying that. And you've got the heir to Winterfell, I guess she's a totem to get the Northerners. Like, well, I guess there's a Stark in Winterfell.
It's not all bad.
Yeah, it could be worse. And you just fuck with them for no good reason.
Yeah.
Other than to satisfy your own base urges. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I like the fact that Rhys kind of put him on notice. Yeah. Like, you know, you better get Theon back. You better get Sansa back. And Sansa better be pregnant because, well, you know, I got another heir coming down the line. It'd be unfortunate if something were to happen to you.
Right.
I thought that was played out pretty well.
What else did you want to say about the Miranda scene?
So first of all, the maester that serves House Bolton, worst post in the Seven Kingdoms, right? Like, how bad do you have to piss off the Grand Maester that your assignment is, you know, hey, for the graduating class of the Citadel, you get sent to the Boltons. Like, that's got to be the worst.
Yeah. Is that who that guy is? A maester standing in the doorway?
There's lots of maesters you got to look for the chains, man. There's a maester running around looking like Obi-Wan Kenobi down at Dorne. That if you blink, you miss him. The second time is Ramsay's decision to butcher the Kennel Master's daughter. Is it because he is pragmatic? Winter's coming, and this is good meat. Is this actually like a gesture that he thinks that she would acknowledge and respect? Is it like I just opened up my heart. Now it's time to shut it up again. And you know what better way to sear what remains of my conscience than to go completely over the top and dismissive of her body?
Sure. And you know the maester's not going to go tell any tales of like, oh, I saw Ramsay basically crying over a body.
Right.
Well, then, yeah, okay, he fed her to the dogs. But...
Yeah, right. I don't know. I thought...
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think he is pragmatic. I think he's a realist and practical in some ways when he's not clouded by sadism. Mm. So that's part of it. But
yeah, and Rhys talking about the well-provisioned Lannister army. I know part of that was to set is the contrast between what he did with the essentially butchering the Baratheon army.
Yeah.
But also, I wonder if it's also to kind of set their position. Like, we just took this castle over. It's half in ruin. There's not a lot of stores. We don't have a lot of food. And it was... this thing he did with, is it Miranda? Is that the Kennel Master's daughter? Was like to kind of show that Ramsay is aware of that.
Yeah, could be.
He don't want his dogs to starve, so.
Sure.
All right.
He needs them to track down Sansa. So we kind of introduced this scene, but Rhys half congratulates Ramsay on his victory over the Baratheon Stannis, and also threatens to delegitimize, is that a word, him as a Bolton for losing Sansa and Theon.
I think he's threatening to kill him. Like, I don't think you can delegitimize a bastard. I don't think there's a legal precedent for that. It's more like just Ramsay was walking on the parapets last night and he fell off and not into a snowdrift.
But only if it's a boy. Like, if it's a girl, he still needs them. Like,
that's exactly right.
That's the thing. So if I'm Ramsay, I'm eyeing that baby. I'm going, okay, as soon as that thing pops out, I need to be there.
And if I'm
Rhys, if I see a dick, it's coming off. A, the dick's coming off. Sure. Or B, it's the baby's dead.
And if I'm Roose, I'm getting an iron crib that just has a whole a feeding right. tube where you could pour food into the kids and like a elimination tube where it comes out. And he's going to stay in there for 18 years because or until Ramsay's dead because...
Let's be honest, like 13 years?
Yeah, that's true. Like when 12 years? When he's a quote-unquote man right. full grown.
Yeah.
The other thing I thought was interesting in this scene was he asks, who landed the killing blow? Now, we talked about an instant cast, and we think that this whole Stannis thing, but I noticed that the emphasis on the second time I watched it, and, like, Ramsay was a little bit of like, oh, no, no one knows. Do you think Roose has seen the body? Do you think Ramsay's seen the body?
No, I don't think so.
Do you think, I mean, I don't understand why Stannis wouldn't show up with Brienne later on if he's still alive, but I feel like they're fucking with us a little bit. Like, deliberately not showing the killing blow.
I don't think mentioning
they are. It here, really?
I just think that they assume, like I assume, that he's dead. Like,
okay.
And that the audience knows that.
Then why, why have this conversation about who's the man that did the killing blow? And why have Roose look, or why have Ramsay look vaguely guilty?
Well, I think it's a little funny because they're assuming, A, that it's a man, which is kind of hilarious to me when Brienne was actually the one to kill him.
Yes, that actually is funny, yeah.
So they're like, oh, our armies must have killed him, when in fact, no, their army didn't even get Stannis. And he might have gotten away.
Yeah, you know what? I think you're right. It works better as just a joke at the Bolton's expense that they can't conceive a woman being able to do this.
Or that they didn't even get the guy. Like,
yeah.
Although he was pretty bloodied. I don't know that he walks out of there if Brienne doesn't come up. No. But
he was all kind of off by his lonesome.
He was, yeah.
Were it not for Brienne, maybe he could have staggered off and at least died in peace. I don't know.
Right.
I think you're right. I think it's just a thematic thing of like them underestimating women in general.
Right. And there's a lot of that stuff in here.
Between Sansa and Brienne, they got real problems on their hands. It's the women that are going to bring them down.
Right. Right, and I mean, Dany's been doing her thing forever. She's, you know, not in the greatest of positions at the moment.
She's a little one step backwards.
Right.
Right now.
Right, she needs a couple forward, but, you know, she's still out there.
Sure.
Exerting her authority, too. So, yeah, let's talk about that scene. Sansa and Theon are running through the woods. They cross a river to avoid the chasing hounds. The hounds find them anyway. Theon tries to hide Sansa, but the guards find her. Just in time, just in the nick of time, Brienne and Pod ride in to save the day. And once the riffraff is disposed of, Brienne pledges her loyalties to Sansa, and Sansa finally accepts her.
Mm-hmm.
Let's save it for the end because it's the end of the scene. But what's with this little huggy moment between Theon and Sansa in this tree? Are they like, okay, we're dead, we're just gonna die here?
Well, I mean, I thought a lot of this scene was touching.
Or is she like forgiving him?
I don't know. It's too hasty to start talking about forgiveness and whatnot. Mm-hmm. But I think that these two people have known nothing but brutality. Theon for God knows how long.
Yeah.
Multiple seasons. Sansa for at least half a season. Again, what does that mean in real time? I don't know. But these people have known nothing but brutality and oppression and degradation. Mm-hmm. And now they're alone, and the other thing is, like, these people have known each other forever. Like, they grew up as kids together in Winterfell. I felt like it was just a genuine, like, you know, I might not be able to fully trust or forgive you for very many reasons, but you helped save me, and I'm freezing to death, and this might be my last moment. I thought it's a nice commentary on the human condition.
Yeah.
That's the instinct to embrace one another rather than to, you know, indulge in some kind of petty jealousy.
Okay. Well, speaking of petty bullshit, my biggest question from the scene, who let the dogs out?
Who let the dogs out? Indeed. Indeed. I mean, I can't believe how much shit was flipped over. I mean, you're right. It is, I guess, but it's such... If you can explain away something as easily as the dogs ran away in the middle of the fight as soon as
with a dude? Like, dude bugged out, took the dogs with him?
Yeah, that too, or like that these dogs feel personally loyal to. I don't know. I mean, so the people do have a point that these are vicious Ramsay dogs, and they're supposed to like be used to tearing people apart. I don't know. Maybe it was tricky to fit because I know you can't hurt an animal. Mm-hmm. And working with animals is a bitch, because that's something that when we talked to Gwendolyn Christie, she mentioned about how the bear, you know, working with the bear was a real right. bear is a nightmare, because they are treated better than actors. Like, you know, you can't make them act, and it's an animal. So I wonder if it's like they had a scene where like maybe someone was supposed to kill a dog, and they just couldn't get it to work that day. I don't know. Okay. But I feel like there's so many practical and just story based solutions to the problem.
Right.
They were killed off scene.
And I feel bad for you if that's what you get hung up on, because this scene is better than that.
And also, that's the thing. Like, if that's what you're focusing on and not, like, the beautiful pledge, the vows that Brienne and Sansa exchange, and the nod that, you know, Pod's not a traditional knight, but, you know, he knows his heraldry and he knows his vows, damn it. And the fact, what really got me is that Brienne... which I don't even think she knows this. I'm not sure if this is what Jamie divulges this in the TV show to her. But this blade is the other half of what,
right?
You know, Tywin melted down the Stark ancestral blade ice.
Yeah,
she's pledging half of Ned's sword in her service, and I thought that was really an emotional moment for the show.
Absolutely,
and that's what's so cool about it is neither of the characters might even know what the significance of that is. And I don't know why. That's kind of dumb, because if nobody, it's like if a touching gesture falls in the woods and no one's there to hear it, you know. But I got it. I got it. It hit me pretty hard, and it looked like
me too.
The way the lighting was and how like it kind of haloed Sansa, it reminded me of this like famous painting, The Accolade, where this beautiful princess or queen is knighting someone. Just the lighting is just so almost otherworldly. It's a great looking scene. I loved the performances with Gwendolyn.
Yeah, she's great in it. I mean, the like look on her face.
Yeah, she's
it may be a little premature to put up the Mission Accomplished banner, but she has at least gotten into the service of one of the Starks. She has half fulfilled her promise to Catelyn.
Yes. And for a person who's that actually means something.
Yes.
It's
a big
amazing.
Deal for her.
Yeah.
And that's what I felt in this scene. Not so much like, oh, she's now going to protect Sansa and this is huge for Sansa, even though it is. I mean, she needs someone in this moment.
Yeah.
But more than that, I think this is important for Brienne.
Yeah. And it's nice to see Pod get his hands dirty a bit. Even Theon.
Do you buy that Pod, under the direction of Brienne, could actually kill a man at this point?
Well, did he actually kill a man, or didn't like Theon have to help out?
No,
he got one kill.
He was fighting with that sworded horseman for a while and then stabbed him while he was on his horse and fell on top of him.
I would think that squiring, like going from squiring to from Tyrion to one of the best pure combat knights in the Seven Kingdoms would do something for your game. Especially when you're talking about mooks. You're talking about dudes that were
mooks.
Just...
You think these guys are mooks?
I mean,
sends mooks after Sansa?
First of all, they're crazy, because they're actually looking forward to people being dismembered, and you know, they're the kennel masters, so apparently they're like one of the ones that are super into people being torn apart by dogs. So and they're after a crippled, unmanned person and a little girl. I don't think they're expecting any, so it's like there's the element of surprise, and the fact, and you can all say, oh, it's a woman, just as she rides off and takes your head off. Like it's like they're not taking it seriously until it's too late.
Sure.
Actually, I was kind of stunned that she had as big a problem as she did. Like, she one-on-one, she beast-moded the Hound, granted a weakened Hound, but still. And she felt, I mean, maybe that's just, it's more exciting to see her struggle a little bit, and, like, there's some genuine danger. But I could go with a little bit of revenge fantasy, where she just comes in and cuts him down.
Okay. She did get kicked in the face right before it.
Sure.
So, like, I'm imagining a little ringing in the ears.
Oh, yeah, no.
And probably, like... you know, not on her A game right
and that,
after
that's
that.
The difference, I guess, between, you know, you want the revenge fantasy, but in real life, especially in this kind of battle, it's like any given Sunday situation.
Yeah, and 5-on-2 is not not terrific odds.
Yes,
you know, or 3 if you count Theon.
That's going as well. It's like 5-on-1.75 because Pod and Theon almost add up to an able fighter.
They're like they add up to a Jaime, I think, at this point. A left-handed Jaime.
A left-handed Jaime, sure.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Our coverage of Hot D, Fire and Blood, and the 1980s Shogun miniseries continues. But then on Tuesday, for the first time in 35 years, we asked a question. Who framed Roger Rabbit? Hop aboard the train to Toontown as we revisit this incredible blending of live action and animation to see if it still holds up all this time later.
Then on Wednesday, we get our first look at Blake Crouch's mind-bending sci-fi series, Dark Matter. The first two episodes drop simultaneously on Apple TV+, and we'll have a pair of podcasts quantumly linked ready for you to observe.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Anything else? I do really like the moment where he tells her, look, we're fucked here. I'm going to take the bullet. You run up to John, to the wall, because John's up there. He's the commander of the Night's Watch.
Yeah.
He'll help you. And we know he's not going to help her. I was a little worried that she was going to run off and head that direction at this moment.
Well, a lot of other people had a problem with just the logistics of this. Like, oh, how convenient Brienne runs right into Sansa at this critical moment. And I'm like, I thought they did a lot of good storytelling to make it plausible that Brienne would be wandering in this patch of woods at this precise moment.
Hmm. Okay. Like I didn't even think about it, but
that's what I'm saying. Like if you consider that a plot hole, like she's literally outside Winterfell. She was at the scene of this battle. She just killed Stannis, if you believe that.
She probably went back to observing.
And you hear these noisy ass dogs, and she's like, I wonder, like, you know,
maybe. I think that's a little bit shakier than who let the dogs out. But
okay, well,
yeah.
Fuck you.
My big beef is proximity and finding people in a world that's so vast. Like,
but that's what I'm saying. They did a great job to shrink it down at this point.
Okay.
Now this, to go back to what you were saying before I derailed you a bit, the obvious play is to head up the Castle Black, though, right?
Seems like it, yeah, even with Brienne.
Because none of these people know that Jon Snow is, I mean, this is all super recent news. So, like, yeah. It feels like that's where they're headed next. They're going to head up north and God knows what happens there.
God, maybe they'll meet Davos with his mutton on the way down.
Yeah.
I doubt it, though.
I like the Sansa just kind of looking regal after all the shit that she went through last year.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's coming into her own. Like we talked about, you know, with her and Littlefinger, he was kind of trying to railroad her, and he did briefly, but I feel like she's starting to make her own tracks now.
I need the great John Umber, the Queen in the North. I need to see that. Okay. Need to see that.
So we go back to King's Landing, and Cersei hears that a ship from Dorne's arriving. She goes down to the harbor to find Jaime on a boat, transporting a coffin with their daughter inside. And later on, Cersei tells a truly endearing story about imagining her mother in the grave, bloating and rotting, It's just a real heart whelmer there. And how it also applies to Marcella. And she's thinking that about her. And then she tells Jamie about this prophecy, which I don't think he knew about before.
Probably not. I can't. That's I don't know how I feel about this characterization of Cersei, because you're right. They humanize her.
It's real interesting.
But it's hard to believe, like, you know, the defiant, proud, invincible Cersei that wouldn't tell her family about this horrifying prophecy and the witch doesn't seem like it's the same type of girl who would fret about her mother rotting in the grave. And, you know, it's like it's almost like each view of that Cersei holds together until you try to merge them together.
Yeah, there's something about Cersei. So the other thing, you know, at the end of this, just to finish up the scene, Jaime pledges we're going to take back everything we lost and more. But in this scene, Cersei's saying, like, I don't know where Marcella came from. She's not anything like me. No meanness, no jealousy. It's remarkably self-aware for a woman who employs those things over and over and over again and lets them get the better of her.
And I would say that's one of the defining traits of book Cersei is the complete lack of self-awareness.
Really?
Which is why it's so jarring to... Yeah, because in the
I've
book,
never seen it until
all throughout
now,
last season when she's like treating with the High Sparrow and she's drinking from her wine and she's like, "Oh, I'm wielding the power of state, so like my own father, Lord Father, couldn't do it better." Glug glug glug. As she's handing over, I mean, she's doing all this thing, and it's like it's a kind of a dark comedy that she's doing all these things that's like you're reading your book. You're like, holy shit, if Tyrion were here, his head would explode twice.
Uh-huh.
And she's just going full throttle for it, not even aware of the danger. And so seeing the self-inspect... I mean, I guess it's a better, more well-rounded character, but it really fucks with me when I got the book image of, you know, Cersei.
Yeah, I mean, I guess... You know, I don't have that perspective on Cersei, but I always
so you're
felt
probably
it.
Got the more valuable perspective that you're coming at it just clean and this is working for you.
I am, but it still kind of surprised me because it implies that she's making these jealous, mean decisions, with at least knowing that she's doing these things, because of those reasons, like.
Which makes
she's
it seem,
too self-aware not to realize that these are bad decisions.
Which makes it seem like this, her being mean and petty and jealous, is like a front,
right? Or
like that's how she thinks she has
she
to
wants
act to
people
be
to
tough,
perceive her.
But she's really a lot more thoughtful and insightful, and you know.
Or I mean, it's entirely possible that she's unable to control those impulses, even though she recognizes they're there.
Yeah, true.
And
that.
That's what's driving her.
Yeah.
Certainly, we all know people like that. So. I don't know. It was certainly another layer to Cersei that I was surprised to see.
Before we move on, you know, we're doing this Telltale playthrough we did last season and
right.
This. There was some word online I could not substantiate that the girl who came in to inform Cersei that the ship had come in was the same person that voiced Mira Forrester. And
okay.
She said, to my ear, it was very... That's the handmaiden main character in the show. It to my ear, it sounds kind of the same, and I know she was blurry and it kind of out of frame, but it looked similar physically too.
Okay.
So I don't know if it'll come out, like if you IMDb, you'll have that character listed. But I thought that was worth mentioning if you're a fan of the game, that there might be a little bit of a nod to the... Because the game, of course,
there
nods,
is crossover,
yeah. But, you know, there hasn't been a lot of it going the other way. This might be a little bit of the Double D's winking at us.
Okay.
Embracing their video game brethren.
The ending of this scene has me somewhat excited. So not as excited as I would have been, you know, season one to see this. But I can't wait to see what angry Jaime is going to do. How he's going to take the army. You know, I assume Tommen's not going to get in his way here.
Well, I mean, that's the thing. Like, for as much setup as we got, there's still a lot of questions we don't have answers to as far as are Tommen, I imagine Tommen and Cersei are still on the outs. You know, can Jaime, on what authority does Jaime march any armies from?
Right. That's the question that I have. I have a feeling he's going to get some armies. He's going to get something.
Yeah.
Some way to strike back. And I'm excited to see that now. Like, this moment is exactly the moment when I wish he hadn't lost his hand, because the fabled Jaime is no longer around.
Sure.
And I want to see the best swordsmen in all of Westeros go to fucking town on fools.
Yeah.
And I can't. I'm never going to get to see that. And it's so sad to me.
Yeah, I wonder if
that's... As a fan of action movies.
I wonder if that's part of his arc, though, to eventually kind of maybe not be quite as good, but be good enough. And maybe it's...
Right, but I don't want to see a good enough fighter take down a bunch of fools. I want to see him massacre his way through a crowd of idiots. I just...
Well, there's something noble. Like, I'm envisioning it in this a moment of, like, self-sacrifice. That, like, old Jaime would have prevailed. Jaime would have just gotten beat. But good enough Jaime is able to save whatever he's trying to save, but maybe die in the process.
It's a different vibe.
Yeah, no. But right. I kind of, like, you know, it's like the last stand of Barristan last season. Like, you know, would I have liked to seen him get out of that? Yes, I would. On the other hand, I felt like the way he went out was fairly heroic because he was dying protecting the people.
Oh, totally.
And he was still pretty badass for an old guy.
Right. And I'm not saying I want to see the heroism out of Jaime. I don't know that that's even there so much.
But it's automatically more heroic when you die in the effort, right? Like, that's the most hallowed hero you can be. You're in Valhalla and...
I guess so. I just want to see a badass moment of the baddest ass of the swordsmen in Westeros being that, and I'm never going to get it, which makes me sad.
Fair enough.
So we go over to Margaery, and she's still in whatever place they're keeping her with the sparrows. The nun continues to try to convince her to confess.
The Great Sept of Baelor, I believe, is what the location.
Is that
location.
The place?
Yeah.
Okay. She just wants to see her brother. Eventually, the High Septon comes in and tells Margaery that, you know, he plays good cop here. Your husband probably misses you.
I bet he does. Bet he does. Can you imagine being a 14 to 15-year-old boy and Margaery Tyrell is in your bed blowing your mind and the night of that day. And she's arrested? And your goddamn mother's
what a tease.
And your goddamn mother's the blame. That's like the worst.
Yeah, I don't envy him.
Ah,
and you know, continuous distress. You need to confess. And there's, you know, a moment here where you get the feeling that you know what kind of happened with Lancel, like where he's saying,
very,
you know, you've started down the path, but you still have miles to travel,
sure.
And like, you know, you chip away at their
psyche
bit by bit. Right.
Yeah.
Because, of course, that's not a question that anyone can answer yes to.
I'd be like, I am perfect. Prove it. Prove me wrong.
Right. So then you start chipping away, right? Like, oh, really? You mixed up the salad fork and the regular fork.
It's like, is she going to pull a full-on Chunk from Goonies where she's just, like, confessing to fake vomiting on the people from the balcony? And...
Right.
The time she cheated on her math and...
Right, and that's the first stepping stone down the path to confessing the larger things. And
sure.
You get a very clear picture of Lancel's predicament.
I wonder where this is going, though. Because, like...
I don't know.
If they break her and her brother and she confesses all these high crimes and treasons, like, I don't know.
Right, and, I mean, does any of that come back on Cersei? I mean, I don't know how it could. It's not like she can confess to what Cersei's done, right?
Right. That's the thing. Cersei might have fucked up because she didn't make a full confession. She did the mercy walk, but not like all of her crimes were not known.
So she
can't. I mean, she can't fully confess her crimes because that delegitimizes the ruling family.
Oh yeah.
But it is. I think it's going to be thematically important that you've got this person who got off with a half confession versus this person who is being held for a full confession.
But if I recall. Cersei didn't get off, right? Like, she's still on the hook for a trial.
Hmm.
Isn't that where they left it? Like, we will let you stay in your castle, but we're going to make you do this shame walk, and you're going to come back for a trial.
Okay. That could be correct.
I think that's where it was.
Honestly, I'm kind of, sometimes my book and show things get crossed.
Okay.
So.
All right. That's what I recall from.
And also
season.
The other thing is like, since I didn't go back and reread Dance and Feast, like also like some of the, like I got caught quote unquote butchering an explanation to you, but I didn't butcher it. I got confused and thought that something that happened in the very tale of Dance was actually a preview chapter for The Winds of Winter, which there's like 12 of those floating around too.
Okay.
So I didn't butcher it. I'm just like, well, that's a spoiler too far to not to talk about something that, you know, is theory. So, like, yeah, it's a mess up here. It's a mess of mispronunciations and spider webs, and
that's what happens when you get a show that's not following the books and books that aren't out yet, and
yep,
preview chapters of books that aren't out
the
yet.
The guy reads hundreds and hundreds of messages a week of all kinds of validity, and it's a fun experience though.
Anything else about that scene, or let's move on to the Sand Snakes?
We can go.
Okay. The Sand Snakes murder Doran for being too weak to strike back at the Lannisters.
The bad pussy strikes again.
It does. And they also kill Trystane, which, you know. I have a big question for you.
I have a bunch of questions about this.
Okay.
But you go first.
Can you tell me who takes over Doran now that Doran and Trystane
That's a damn fine
dead?
Question. No. I have not even gotten out to family trees and seen, like,
okay,
any of that stuff.
All right.
I'm pretty goddamn sure a bastard daughter, you know, like, I'm pretty sure a bastard
right.
daughter of a bastard daughter can't inherit.
Yeah, and, like, the wife of, like, the oldest prince, right? It's she's uh-huh. not... I don't think
she's not even
eligible,
the wife,
but
she's just slant. She's
right,
the paramour,
right.
slant
I forgot
piece,
about that.
Whatever you want to call it.
So, I don't know who takes over Doran. Doran, sorry.
It could be, like, this is a, like, in the same way that the Sparrows have kind of taken over King's Landing, this could be some kind of popular, because that's how they...
I think that's a lie, though. I don't... So, here's the question. I've never lived under the rule of a king or a queen.
Oh, okay.
I know.
We'll have to ask her what are British fans, what that's like.
Right. I was going to say, I know there are people in this world who have and who have a
under
a
the
culture.
Cruel heel of Elizabeth II.
Right.
Probably, I shouldn't talk
she's
shit
no
on
Cersei.
This. She just had her birthday last week. I shouldn't talk shit about her.
But there are people who have that ingrained in their culture, right? And
yeah.
they may have opinions on this.
Mm-hmm.
Is there that much loyalty to the royalty? Loyalty to the royalty. That's my question. Do they give a shit that their daughter is killed, or not even their daughter is killed? Well, one of them is raped and killed. The daughter of, you know, a betrothed daughter of the Lannisters uh-huh. to their prince is killed. Do the people care about that, or do the people care about what Doran thinks they care about, which is being happy and prosperous?
So it's interesting you mention that, because that's something I think about a lot too, because, like, you know, one of my favorite book series is the Patrick O'Brien Aubrey Maturin series, and, you know, obviously the king means a whole hell of a lot, especially to, you know, to people in the military, like God save the king and all that in the king's name. That's like shit that actually mattered. And I'll say, even in modern times, there was just a thread on Reddit where there's this Republican Party, a Republican movement, small r, like that wants to abolish the monarchy in the UK.
Yeah.
And they took the opportunity of Queen Elizabeth the Second's birthday to talk about how she should be the last queen, like it should, like, Charles shouldn't ascend, and this should just, and I was shocked at the percentage of Brits that were like, fuck these guys, fuck them. Like, I think that, and I saw a couple of people try to explain, like, that, you know, the royal, it's like, yeah, they don't have any real power. But you know, that is kind of the embodiment of what it's to be. Like, that's kind of like, you know,
symbol.
The same way
yeah.
a patriotic American would feel about the flag being trampled into the mud.
Right.
And then,
yeah.
like, the fact that you would tear down this institution with thousands of years of history behind it and
sure.
all this, you know, and, you know, the tourism and all that other stuff. So I feel like that, you know, this is a weak sauce, watered down version of what you would feel about royalty when it actually mattered.
Okay.
Like when like you, like, this is a secular watered down, but like if you're believing that these people are handed their mandate down from God
mm-hmm.
and that they are like have this blood right to rule, and like someone, I could see how that would be something that would piss people off. On the other hand, they're couching this as if it's a popular uprising, which kind of surprised
yeah.
me that everyone in Doran is like, the gossip rags are like, fucking Doran sitting there on his goddamn wheelchair with
yeah.
his prince, and they're sleeping with the Lannisters, and they're the ones that kill their princess. And I and the fact that none of the House Guards did anything.
No, they're all in on
it. Kind of shows
that
it has to be a popular uprising.
Seems like it.
So
yeah.
I thought that was interesting.
I still think it's a bad decision. I think Doran is a much better ruler than someone who's out for vengeance.
But that's the thing. Like, so people are mad that, like, well, Doran gets killed with, like, very little fanfare. Although
it sucks because I like that actor, but
I do too.
I'm not angry story wise.
I mean, you know, this is Sean Bean all over again. And right. Also, like, I think this is part, like, this could be part of something Martin's saying that, like, this popular uprising that's concerned with justice and vengeance. You want, maybe the theme is that you want this kind of slow, patient, staid, slow burn ruler. That's like, you know, even I think it's funny that Ilaria is even saying, like, yeah, my brother would be a terrible ruler, but I'm going to kill you now.
And this is exactly what he would have wanted.
I'm like, a more impetuous, less, you know, graceful about expressing it version of my, of your brother, my lover.
And less badass flips, let's be honest.
Sure.
Come on.
Sure. But I thought, that's what I'm saying. Like, I'm not outraged by the Doran thing because, like, I didn't rage quit the show when Ned Stark died.
Right.
I like Doran. Doran is a little bit more interesting in the books, but I do believe that this is kind of how that story is going. And yeah, Doran's not that good in the books. There, I said it.
Okay.
There's a lot of silly shit.
The feedback, my God.
Like, do you want Darkstar? You want fucking Darkstar in your Game of Thrones television series? Is that what you want? Like, no. So yeah, I'm blowing your mind, but I'm talking to the book readers here.
Okay. I don't have a problem with it storytelling wise. I think it's a terrible decision for Dorne, the Nation of Dorne.
Sure, and I think that's part of the theme too. You go from Oberyn saying we don't kill little girls in Dorne to, you know, hey, we're kinslaying, we're reverse violating guest right, YOLO. I mean, like, that can't be good, right?
No, it's a terrible thing. Yeah. It's also bad for the Lannisters. I mean, obviously, it's gonna come down on them. Mm-hmm. This is a real bad thing for all of Westeros, in my opinion. Like, the most level-headed people are no longer around. Tyrion's fucking
and one of the last unspoiled full-strength kingdoms aside from the Vale that has not
is
been,
now going to get mixed up with fucking King's Landing. I mean,
which doesn't matter.
And it's going to distract them from the Boltons, which are righteous shits. I mean, you don't want these guys coming in and mopping up the battle that they thought they were going to have.
Yeah.
I mean, it's going to be what Littlefinger said, except it's going to happen at King's Landing.
Yes.
And it's going to happen with the Boltons sweeping in and taking over.
Could be. I mean, that's the thing.
It's
Bruce Bolton's worried
scene.
About a fully provisioned Lannister army marching north when it seems like Jaime's going to be all pissed off and marching himself.
Right.
And Roose is going to be the Mr. Burns of Westeros, as he always is.
Excellent.
Okay.
Yeah, so bad,
holy
bad
shit,
news
this
all
be a
around
long podcast.
For everyone. Yeah, it is. Tyrion and Varys are walking through the city and arguing about what needs to be done.
Whoa, whoa, whoa. Didn't we skip the whole scene with Tristan on the ship?
I mean, I mentioned it if you want to.
Oh, well, that's the
it.
Other giant plot hole that people had a problem with.
Right, I don't care. It's not a huge plot hole.
I mean, people essentially are saying these people were on the dock and they sailed off. There's no possible way they could have ever gotten ahead or the passage of time could explain. Like, I'm just telling you.
Right. This timeline is not one-to-one.
Jaime takes
here.
Off on a merchant ship. Well, they get on a cutter and they outsail him.
Isn't that a thing with the Dornish ships? Aren't they fast? Don't they make a thing of that sometimes?
I think that's the Iron Islanders that have the seafaring ships. But no, I mean, like, that's that. Like, going back to my Patrick O'Brien, like, they could board like a very small, fast cutter and make twice the sea miles that this merchant ship is making.
Right, and there's no telling when this happens. Like, he's just sitting out on Jaime's boat, presumably to be hidden away. Right,
that's the thing. I feel like the small council's like, we don't know what to do with this guy yet. He's a valuable piece. We're not going to be like the Boltons, so we're confining him to the ship.
Yep.
And Tristan loves Myrcella. I mean, he's painting her rock eyes.
Right.
And, you know, because obviously he thinks he can do the better. He's done the most recent staring into them, so he can do it upright.
Now, that pins down the timing a little bit. It says he hasn't been there for weeks, probably.
True. Yeah, you're right. You're right.
So, you know, unless, you know, he's been painting these things for weeks, and the ones that they used have been long done. But it seems like he... This is within a couple of days.
But yeah, I mean,
arriving.
I don't want the show to, you know, make sure that we saw that the Sand Snakes were sent on this mission and that they were in the fastest ship on Dorne. Like, I don't need those scenes. So to me, it's not a plot hole because there's many conceivable possibilities available in this world that would explain how they got infiltrated the ship and killed him. Now, is it, you know, that's the other thing. It's like, oh, well, where are the Lannister guards? Do you really think in this universe any number of Lannister guards could protect Tristan from the Sand Snakes?
Of course not.
No fucking way.
Yeah, I don't buy it. The show itself, though, I'll play devil's advocate here a little bit, does kind of encourage us to say, okay, where is everyone?
That's true.
What is the timing of this? How are things going to play out? It does encourage us to do that. So when they take shortcuts like this, I can see why people might feel a little
I think the shortened. Scene, and to be fair, I think the scene is a bit confusing. They frame the shot that it's the ship and it's in the middle of the harbor, and then Tristan's there, and then the Sand Snakes. Like,
right.
Maybe it's a bad idea to have him there, but then again, if the Double D's are like, well, if we put him in the dungeons, then you got to explain how the Sand Snakes got down. So, again, I'm not that bothered by it. I'm more bothered by the Sand Snakes continuing being lame.
Yeah.
Like the whole, like, oh, we're competitive, and oh, you killed the guy, and you're a greedy bitch. Like, that stuff's still not landing for me.
Yeah, me either. So let's move over to Tyrion and Varys. They're walking through Meereen, and they're arguing about what needs to be done here. They stop to give money to a poor woman with a baby. They see some graffiti, and they see a man inciting a civil war, essentially. Eventually, they see people running and follow the source back to the docks, where they find all of the boats on fire. They're not going anywhere.
And 1,000 show watchers cried out as Tyrion said, well, we won't be sailing to Westeros anytime soon.
Right. But he doesn't need a boat. He's got a dragon. He's got dragons. Don't worry. He's going to Westeros pretty soon.
I don't want three adolescent dragons.
Three episode countdown. Okay. That's what I'm going for.
All right. I did get a lot of feedback. I'm going to save some of this discussion for feedback section. But there are people that are really looking at their watch and tapping their feet on this. Like, for fucking real.
They're setting.
You had 100 ships perfect to take across to Westeros, and now they're burnt.
Yeah. It's going to take a while to rebuild those or find a new set.
I thought it was pretty funny that Tyrion, like, tries to win hearts and minds, and he can't speak Valyrian worth a damn. So he's she thinks he's wanting to eat her baby. And,
right.
And
pretty good.
And I don't know why this stuff scene. Like this shit's silly, and like stuff that the Dothraki got up to later. Yeah. I don't know why I accept to varying degrees of success that, and like the over the top shit the Sand Snakes do pisses me off. Except for I think that these actors just have better chemistry.
Certainly,
it could come down to just better chemistry,
and better line delivery. Yeah,
yeah. So,
there seems to be a civil war brewing in this city. I mean, even more than there was when Daenerys was in town.
And also, it wasn't just anybody inciting the people to riot. It was a Red Priest.
Was it? Okay.
Yeah, he was mentioned in Lord of the Light, and he's wearing red robes. I thought that was... I don't know why, but I think it's significant that there's this... that's also... It's like... It kind of tells you that the whole Red Religion is not a top-down organization. Mm-hmm. Because you got all these different priests that completely cross purposes from one another.
Yeah.
Which is an interesting look at a medieval religion.
All right.
There's also the scene of some mysterious guy watching them. I don't know what I'm supposed to... clearly an intelligent person is watching them. I don't know if it's to show that Varys is boasting of his birds and are showing that whoever this faction of the Harpies is has their own birds that Varys doesn't even know about.
Right.
I'm not sure what we're supposed to notice it, but I'm not sure why we're supposed to notice it yet.
I think it gives a good sense of foreboding that maybe they're being watched. The Sons of the Harpy.
Yeah.
Are calculating how they can get rid of these fools.
Yeah.
We'll see. So Jorah and Daario search for Dany. They roam the countryside, eventually finding a burnt goat. Burnt ram's head, and a ring around a ring, and decide that the Dothraki have her.
Yeah, we might have a difference of opinion here, because I thought it was actually fairly clever, because, you know, you and I are both like, oh, for fuck's sake, I don't care if you're the best tracker in the world, you're not going to be able to find this ring in the middle of this vast grass pasture. But then when you see it, and you can see, like, these 10,000 horses riding in a ring. There's that patch of unspoiled grass in the middle that Jorah investigated. And I'm like, oh, okay. This is actually way better than I thought was going to happen.
Sure, that's fine. Like, having the ring around the ring there is cool. And it makes a lot of sense, given what we saw last season.
Mm-hmm.
I just, like, is there a saying, is there a literal saying in the world of Westeros, at, like, straight as the dragon flies? Because, like... Do dragons not turn in midair? Do dragons not get attracted by, well, oh, shiny, and I mean, go that
leave,
way?
They leave burnt patches of grass. They leave dismembered goats. They, I mean, dragon but shit, right? Like, I'm thinking, like, every mile or so on this big grassy sea, you're going to see, like, a hefty glad bag laying on the ground and, like, oh, it's dragon spore.
Right. Like, okay. I mean, I didn't consider that.
I know
that.
People that can track a deer through a woods. Tracking a dragon across a plain's got to be easier than that. Well, they're screaming all the time.
You're right. I didn't calculate for dragon shit. Nobody thinks about dragon shit.
It's, that's, yeah.
You
no
think about dragon's
it.
Fire. Like, per, like, statistically speaking, dragon shit causes more damage than dragon fire.
So far.
It's, yeah, like, it's a known fact in,
like,
Westeros.
Anytime you see a shadow of a dragon flying over a bunch of amazed people looking up with their mouths open, you just, like, cringe.
They're horrified by what could be dropping.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
I got, like, I got shit on by a pelican once in Seattle. You scale that fucker up 100 times, it's lethal damage, man. I felt like I got hit by an egg. Like, I honestly thought someone threw an egg at me, and then I'm like, what? Oh, Jesus! Fuck you, pelican! Fuck all the pelicans!
Wow.
Anyway.
I thought there was some clunky dialogue in this, when Jorah and Dario are talking, and they say, oh, if you grow old, and then he's like, I hope I grow old. I'd like to see the world when Dany conquers it. Like,
really? I thought that was pretty good.
I thought the dialogue was clunky there.
I guess I was expecting a bigger shit show. I was expecting this to be really dumb, and the fact that it's kind of that Dario is a little bit, like I mentioned, the instant cast, a little deferential to Jorah.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's just a rope-a-dope him.
But I also know that I noticed that Jorah doesn't even look at Dario during this scene. Like, Dario's looking directly over at him as he says, like, oh, it must feel pretty shitty to have this woman you love and can't get to her. And
yeah, that's just,
Jorah just
that
doesn't even look at him.
Yeah, yeah.
And he, like, doesn't want to see what's going on there.
But, I mean, yeah, it must this has got to be hell for Jorah.
Yeah.
Because he's with this man who's having this relationship with this woman that he wants, and he's a scoundrel, and he's not good enough for her, and all the other nice guy bullshit he's probably saying. But, yeah, there you go.
All right, let's go over to the Dothraki Raiders with Dany. They're making some crude small talk about her as they march her through the desert, whipping her in the process. Once they get back to camp, they take her to the cowl.
Before we move on, do you think there's intentional symmetry between them pondering her white pussy hair and the Melisandre reveal at the end? Is that foreshadowing?
I don't. Sure. Yes, absolutely it is. Good catch. they take her back to the cowl there in the camp, and there are a couple of broad comedic jokes here. That she, before she reveals that she's the widow of Khal Drogo, which causes this cow to proclaim, no one's going to touch you, and we're taking you to cow widow storage. I mean,
so we've seen Vaz Dothrak. That's the place where Dany ate the horse heart in season one.
Okay.
Where she was taken and the old women prophesied about her. That's apparently when a cow dies, he leaves a widow. It's a ritual thing that they take all these old women. And they make him. It's not even a real capital city. It's where they mention they take the gods and things from other conquered people, and they kind of hoard it there. It's like, look at all those people we fucked.
Jesus. So she's literally back to where she started.
Pretty much.
Oh my god.
But there's. I mean, that's the thing. Like, that so sucks. I got some email about from people that I'm going to get to and broader about how they're mad that Dany's back, and oh god, Dany's being, she's good, she's under the threat of rape again, and all these bad things, and she's been depowered. I think the big difference is she speaks Dothraki fluently, and that automatically makes her seem a bit more cunning, because these guys don't know that she's overhearing what they're saying, and she's kind of like looking around like she's trying to pin her exact location. I felt like there's a lot of things, like the difference between the 18-year-old, if I'm being charitable, Dany being drug off by Khal Drogo, and this version of her, I thought the intelligence, the experience, the confidence, the worldliness is where I thought you could see a lot more of her power and agency. Just the fact that she knows more than the people that are dragging her off in the situation, I thought made me feel like she's going to be okay, that she's going to be able to navigate these things, and that... you know, maybe, and that's the other thing, like, maybe she even expected this. Like, being, do you believe that these widows are going to be able to hold Dany there if she wants to go? Like, her ending up in this...
I don't know.
And also there's this weird prophecy about the stallion that mounts the world that they talked about in the first season that looked like it petered out, but I wonder if she's going to, like, the if I recall correctly, these widowed former Khaleesis have a great deal of respect amongst the people. Like, that's kind of like their, you know, like where a lot of their knowledge and cultural heritage is at. So okay. If Dany could, like, sway this, you know, on paper they have no power, but they have a lot of esteem and privilege. If she could sway them to some, like, you know, the fact that, hey, I'm actually the fulfillment of your prophecies and I have these dread, these are the children that you were seeing. I wonder if that's going to be significant, that's going to swing the Dothraki back into her favor.
It certainly could. It's a better outcome than Jorah and Daario ride in and save her, right?
Which, that's the thing. If that's what I think is correct, then, I mean, I guess the less interesting version of that is they just have they assault the City of Widows and rescue her.
It's like a Monty Python skit where they're slashing people running up stairways. It's ridiculous, but I think that's a better scene for Dany than her being rescued by these dudes.
We'll see.
Yeah, we will see. I'm sure of it. So we go over to Arya, who's begging in Braavos. Braavos, that's the name of it. The girl from the Hall of Faces, whose name I don't fucking know.
Let's agree to call her the Waif.
The Waif, okay.
Or Stick, if you want to call her Stick.
I like Stick. she approaches and hands Arya a stick and begins beating her mercilessly.
Uh-huh.
And once the beating is over, takes several minutes, she says, "I'll be back tomorrow," and leaves.
Mm.
So you get an idea of what is in store for Arya here.
But also Arya, I thought, because I didn't notice this in the first view, but I always, on subsequent viewings, turn on closed captioning. And they were showing her listening to people, what they were saying. Like, she's absorbing, right. And you could... There's nothing...
This is not... So
this is a mission they're sending her on now.
Absolutely. She is still in training, right? Yeah. Like, they said, look, this is your second strike.
Yeah.
You don't get another one.
Yeah.
But she's not out. Like, she's not begging on the streets because she's blind and doesn't have anywhere to go.
And now she's no longer distracted. I think we're going to see a progression of her. Like, now it's all a jumble of voices and she can't focus. But after she gets used to, you know, developing her hearing, I bet in subsequent episodes we'll actually see her learn interesting and useful info.
Yeah, and she's learning what it is to be no one, to not even be noticed, right? I mean, she's becoming a ghost.
There's going
to
be this progression of both her prowess at fighting blind and also the fact that she's now open, so much more open to the world in this particular, you know, sense of hers. I think that's kind of cool and interesting. And also, that final shot of her, like, on her hands and knees, bloodied with the Titan of Braavos over her shoulder was so rad. And I almost wonder if they actually did a mock-up of that statue and put it, like, it's not obvious as big, but it's like, you know, it's 40 foot tall and it's actually only 50 feet away, because that thing looked, I get it's blurry, and I guess it wouldn't be that hard to do a blurry CGI, but man, that thing looked real. Like, that whole, like, the fact that they use these on-set locations and stuff just makes the show feel so fucking real in a way that, like, The Walking Dead rarely does. Like, so many of their locations are contrived, and they're taking over whole cities and all across the world to get this stuff off. Like, the money they spend, you can see every penny of it on screen.
For sure.
Unless it's Dany riding a dragon, and then that shit's rubber and hokey and bullshit. But they nailed the Titan of Braavos.
We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car?
The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, the very special isn't your speed. We've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
Anything else about this, or should we move
on? Let's move on.
Okay. Alistair knocks on Davos' door and promises to grant amnesty to all the brothers in the room who put down their arms by nightfall. Nobody believes him. Not a single one. No, fuck no.
Yeah, I didn't think so either. Doesn't seem like the kind of guy that would forgive.
No.
Although...
we're both knights, and yeah.
That's a Jon Snow move, not a Thorne move. Jon Snow would forgive the people who... And that's the thing. They're not even traitors. They're loyalists. No.
She's true.
You know?
But not Alistair. So Davos suggests that maybe the Red Woman might be able to help him out. Mm. And then we cut to the Red Woman. She takes off all her clothes. We see the beautiful Melisandre we're familiar with. She takes off the necklace and turns into a hideous old skin bag.
Well, she turns into an old woman. I don't know.
The oldest of women. I mean, it's not just old woman.
Yeah, well, that's where we're all
here.
Headed, if we're lucky.
If we're lucky,
that's
yeah. This
thing.
Is what Dario's going to look like.
Everybody
if
like, oh, this old woman's, oh, you're all going to be looking like, your balls are going to be hitting the toilet water when you go take a shit. Your boobs are going to sag down to your knees. This is where we're all headed before the grave, if we're lucky. If we're lucky, we live a long time.
You're right. If I live to 110... I'll look exactly. I'll have the same tits and everything.
You probably will.
I will. So, a lot of questions about this scene.
Although I've seen you with your shirt off, your nipples aren't nearly as high up on your chest as hers are.
No.
Those things I've always thought that most of the bodies in this show, I know this is your appearance.
Are enhanced.
No. I've always thought that they've taken care to have like mostly natural bodies, but like,
of the women in this show are like 20. So...
Well, even still, like, can you not tell the difference between bolted on pair of titties and natural?
I'm saying it's a little more obvious when
I feel like
you're
that she's
in your 40s.
That's the thing, that she's the definitely an enhanced specimen, I would say.
I think so. If not, hats off.
I mean, Hodor got to wear a prosthetic cock that makes him look like a giant.
That's true.
So it's like, you know, it's only fair. You got enhancements for everyone.
So, do we want to talk about this necklace? Because it's a thing that everyone's talking about.
I mean, it flashed red. It's like...
It flashed red, and notably, when she took it off, she turns into the older version of Melisandre, the less attractive version. Now, we've seen her with her necklace off before.
Yeah, and...
Right? In that scene you mentioned very early on in the podcast.
Yes.
Where she's taking a bath in season 4.
Yes.
Does not have the necklace on, but still looks like hot Melisandre.
Uh-huh.
So, why the change this time?
So, number one, it could just be a continuity error.
Okay.
I mean, that's just...
She forgot to put the actress didn't put the necklace on in the bath.
No, I'm not saying that. The double Ds weren't even thinking of that. The fact that Melisandre's got this thing going on and George, like, dropped a note to him. That's a possibility. From the interviews I've seen with him, it doesn't appear that that's the possibility. The other thing is, I think... So, it's interesting because that happened in season 4 and people wrote in on the spoiler cast. And I kind of poo-pooed it. Like, they're like, oh, maybe Selyse got to see the true... Because it kind of looked like she was shocked or whatever. And I still, to this day, think that the faces she was making was because she was trying to pussyfoot around to asking the question of whether you fucked my husband. Or whether you had to use a potion on him. And she was uncomfortable with the conversation.
Right.
But now I feel like, maybe there's two possibilities. Number one, the whole conversation was about Selyse didn't need the tricks and the glamour to see the quote-unquote truth. Mm-hmm. And Melisandre spouting all this about this is all just flesh. It's not the real thing. It could be, if we're looking back in hindsight, that, yes, Selyse did see that she used this old crone. But it didn't matter because she saw the true prophet of the Lord of the Light, and she didn't need the glamour to accept it. But we, with our, you know, looking through the cameras, I guess, did see the fiction.
I feel secondly, slightly cheated by that.
Secondly, if you real carefully, as they show, or real quickly, as they show the scene, and this scene's great because I love the old-timey brass mirror and how kind of creepy that was when you became aware that it's this old woman, and it's just kind of like sin tingles up my spine. But they pan over a bunch of vials that look like they were like in various stages of empty. And before she laid down the ruby, and in the previous scene with Selyse, she actually had Selyse fetch her one of her vials after she explained that all these things are magical and they glamour, and she put the potion into her bath and then like had a physical reaction, like, oh, like power entering her. It could be that it's the potion doing it.
Yeah.
And maybe that the, I mean, I could spin, how much bullshit do you want me to spin here, Jim?
Right, all of it. No.
Like, it could be that that crystal's an emergency backup and she's running out. It could be that she's saving up all of her Lord of the Light juice to do something crazy with Jon Snow.
Right.
It could be that this is just a woman's bedtime routine.
Right. Yeah.
My girlfriend takes her makeup off at night and she doesn't look like she's 400 years old, but, you know. that's the thing that women do. Like, why do you want to sleep with all this shit on you and go to bed as hot Melisandre?
Of course. And most, I think the most important thing here to see is the flash of the necklace, right? I mean, they clearly want us to notice it.
Mm-hmm.
They want us to know that this necklace
is special.
Has something to do with Melisandre and her powers.
And
I don't know what. I don't think anybody knows what.
Yeah,
exactly.
That's an accurate statement.
So... I'm just looking forward to seeing more of it, seeing what happens there.
Yeah. I also think it just shows, again, the theme of her just being beat down.
Mm-hmm.
And if you recall, in our conversation with Thoros of Myr, he said that like it was at the point where I was at my lowest of the faith and I didn't even believe in the Red God that I accidentally resurrected my best friend.
Right.
Or not my best friend, but whoever, you know, my comrade in arms. I wonder if they're setting up a parallel for that, too.
Could be.
I mean, there's lots of possibilities and theories here.
Yeah.
Pick which one, and we'll see who's right.
Right.
But yeah, no, it's...
That is super important, though, to realize how disenfranchised, how disheartened Melisandre feels at this moment.
Pretty low.
Yeah.
Also, so she's going to sleep. Apparently, I guess it's getting to be nighttime, that implies. And Sir Alistair said that we're beating down the door before it's dark.
Yeah.
Is there some kind of ticking time bomb clock situation here? Like, if she's going to do something with Jon Snow, is Alistair the kind of guy that's going to be like, yeah, make way for the Red Lady? He seemed kind of dismissive of her. Like, you can take her with, or you can leave her here. I don't know what they would do with her if they did leave her here.
Here's a question for you. Let's say Melisandre is gassing up to take a run at resurrecting Jon Snow.
Yep.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
She's going to bring back Jon Snow from death. How does that change the equation? They're still locked in this room. They're still outnumbered. Alistair Thorne probably will kill Jon Snow a second time, I imagine. Will it change the other brothers' minds? Will they not fight against a Jon Snow risen from the grave?
I mean, that's such a... These people have not dealt with any... I mean, they've dealt with the... I guess the other thing is they're prejudiced against... Things come back from the dead.
Right.
They seem like they're prejudiced against.
Uh-huh.
So, like, I could see it going anyway. Like, and that's the other thing is, like... at what point do we say Jon Snow's just dead? Like, 5 episodes in the season?
Probably, yeah. It depends on how many more times we see scenes at Castle Black, but
yeah.
I think the more we see at Castle Black and the less we see Jon Snow coming back from the dead, we can start to deduce maybe he's gone.
That's the other thing. I guess I was pleased because in my heart of hearts, I was thinking, okay, Aaron, brace yourself for Jon Snow just coming back to life in like the first 15 minutes of the show, which I thought would have been dumb.
Yeah.
I thought that'd have been like Walking Dead levels of bullshit plot. You know, I was actually relieved to see that they're giving this time to fester and build and us to wonder really what the hell's going on.
Right.
So... You know, I guess that's another perspective I came from, is I was expecting things to be a lot crazier and dumber, and I was pleasantly surprised that everything held together. And I thought, again, great episode to set up what's sure to be a barn burner of a next episode.
Right, and it handily explains why, you know, Jon's body wouldn't be burned, like, all of this stuff. They just got to it before
I get there's some feedback on
that. I mean,
that
I don't know why they leave him out there.
That's the question. But I think there's some ease that you can hand wave away, but they didn't. You know,
right?
Anytime I'm getting to the point where I'm saying the show's, I'm mentally hand waving away three or four objections, I got to give credit to the other side. It's like, yeah, that is, some of that stuff needs to be addressed in show. Not all sure. of it, but sure. This is the fourth time I think I've said, well, you can easily, but yeah, well, the fourth up. Time it's not as easy.
Right.
Okay. But I don't know. We'll talk about some more of that in the feedback. Today's sponsor for our podcast is Audible, and they are offering our listeners a free 30-day trial membership. All you got to do is go to audiblepodcast.com/baldmove and browse over 180,000 audio programs. Download a title free and start listening. It's that easy. Go to audiblepodcast.com/baldmove and get started today. And I'm supposed to, at this point in the copy, I'm supposed to make a pick, a staff selection, if you will.
Pulling back the kimono a bit, yeah? We have copy, we have...
Gee whiz, Jim, what am I going to recommend?
All the Game of Thrones books that have been released in the past? I don't know.
Yeah, how about the complete collected works of George R.R. Martin?
Yeah.
And here's the thing, this is I've never been an audiobook fan.
Okay.
But this is why Audible changed its mind, because you know what I am a fan of? I'm a fan of Kindle. And Kindle readers.
Right.
And by the way, you got a tablet, you got a smartphone, you got a Kindle reader. I love the fact that I can read at night. It's my habit before I go to bed. I wake up in the morning, I take my son to school, or I'm commuting here and there. I can hit my Audible player, and through Amazon's WhisperSync technology, the two are instantly synced together. So the exact moment where I stopped reading the night before, the narrator starts reading. And then when I get home, the book synchronizes, and it's all behind the scenes. You don't have to worry about it. And it's awesome. Like, I've been using it. I'm working my way through the Harry Potter series with my son.
Mm-hmm.
It's great. I read it to him before we go to bed at night, and then we have to take a long trip to Indiana. We can listen to that all the way over there, and then when it's time to read to him when we get to his aunt's place, it's ready to go. It is amazing. And the other cool thing that they've added, this might be something they've had a long time, but it's in the talking points now, is their great listen guarantee.
How's that?
If you decide you don't like the book that you choose, no worries. You can exchange any book you aren't happy with for any title, anytime, no questions asked. It sounds pretty painful. I've never had to, because like I've had so many books that I've wanted to, and I knew they were great and going to be great. But no, I think it's an awesome feature. They got a lot of great books. Again, over 180,000 titles. Surely there's something you'd like. It's been my habit to play a snippet from the books, but I was at a loss this week because there's a couple things that I kind of want to play. Like there's a really great speech that Doran gives when he's still alive in the books, but there's a little bit of different characters and some spoiler stuff I wanted to do, like when Arya was blinded in the books, but it's so completely different that I'm like, we're really in uncharted territory. But you know how you can plot your own course? You go to audiblepodcast.com/baldmove, get your free 30-day trial, grab one of Martin's books, like Game of Thrones, and start plugging away. Because there is so much more to the story, and so much more detail, and so much more richer experience that, in my case, it's enhanced my enjoyment of the show. Obviously, reasonable people disagree on that. But yeah, audiblepodcast.com/baldmove. Go get your free 30-day trial right now. You can send feedback to gameofthrones@baldmove.com or get on our forums, forums.baldmove.com. Remember, everything's segregated from spoilers, non-spoilers. I know we're getting close to the being beyond the books, but we're still not quite there, so help me and Jim out by clearly marking your spoiler discussions and stick to the spoiler thread if you want to talk about shit happening in the books or theories based on book speculation. Anyway, going on to feedback, Chris Z has a theory for us. Since Valyrian steel is supposedly forged from spells and dragonfire, which is a supposed thing, isn't it possible that someone, such as Dany, could quote-unquote break the wheel by destroying the Iron Throne with Dragonfire, thereby transforming that steel into Valyrian swords? Perhaps with an assist from Sam and his studies of the books or the scrolls or whatever. Mm-hmm. Or maybe we're halfway there anyway. He did some wiki research, said the Iron Throne is supposedly formed from the 1,000 swords that were surrendered to Aegon before the War of the Conquest, or after the War of the Conquest, were then melted down by fiery breath of Aegon's dragon before being beaten and made into a throne. So maybe the Lannisters and Baratheons have been sitting on the ultimate weapon all along.
Yeah, I mean,
That's popular speculation. That
right. I've wondered about that for a long time now.
The Iron Throne will literally be like this vast repository of awesome, magical white and White Walker weapons.
It just never seemed to me like that was enough. Like, there's not enough material there to make enough
swords
to make a difference in
battle. Didn't
Littlefinger
say that he counted some once and there was like 300-some, so it's not even 1,000?
It's not going to turn the tide of the battle. Like, that's the thing. I mean, maybe if you get them strategically into the right hands of the people who can kill the leaders of the
or
White
what if
Walkers.
Instead,
like,
instead of going swords, you make them into arrowheads.
Okay. All right.
Because how many White Walkers are there anyway? There's a shit ton of whites, but no, I mean that's a fairly popular piece of speculation. And somehow the fact that the Iron Throne that everyone's chasing will be centrally important in some weird kind of way that this way, but we'll have to see. Double A Ron T says, can we get a weekly worry meter for whether Jon Snow will return? With 10 being the most worried, I'd say I'm already at a 5 or 6. How about you guys?
Jesus, I'm at a 3.
Yeah,
it's pretty low so far.
2 to 3. Now, each week that it goes, because my magic number is the third episode. I think the third episode is where shit will go down. And he'll stop pining for the fjords, and he'll either be all the way dead, or he'll be in some version of undead, or not dying, or back from the dead Jon Snow.
Yep.
But that's, you know, every episode we get up to that, I'm going to get a little bit more nervous, and then past that, I'm going to crank up the 10 pretty quickly. Devin from Virginia has a quick question. How the hell did the Sand Snakes get on a boat with Trystane? So this is the other side. Last season, we all saw them standing on the pier as they watched the boat sail away from Dorne. So again, the pier, the location from which boats are launched, a singular boat, they watch depart.
Right, the only dock in all of Dorne.
All of Dorne. And it is a dock. It's a perfectly functional boat dock, presumably with other boats nearby.
Right.
Now two of them somehow magically, on the very boat they watched sail away, are appearing. Mm. Did the boat circle back after discovering Marcella was poisoned? Did the two sisters get on a rowboat and row out to the main ship?
They wakeboarded. The entire way across.
Did they ride up to King's Landing, somehow beat the boat there? Now that's another possibility.
They rowed faster than the boat?
Well, I don't know how the...
They have to kind of do a...
Well, that's the thing. In real life, you can't, like, if you sail from, the old world to the new, you can't come back at the same latitude and the same path because the trade winds aren't working in your favor. So it could be that they either have to tack and beat up all the entire coast, and it's an arduous journey that you could, with the right team of horses and the right people to resupply, be faster overland.
Maybe.
Possible. Don't think so in the mountainous region of Dorne, but that's a possibility that I haven't seen mentioned yet.
Does Dornish at least have awesome horses? Is that a thing that's established? Can we give something awesome to Dorne?
Dorne has awesome
wine.
Libidos and wine.
Okay.
And good weather. Hot good weather. Anyway, he goes, this continuity error, combined with the fact that they killed off the only Dornish characters I actually wanted to see more of, the fact that they're busy on the underdeveloped characters who supposedly badassery I don't buy, it looks like the Dorne plot will continue to be terrible. The rest of the episode is absolutely great, don't get me wrong, but it looks like Dorne will continue to be the laughingstock of the show.
It's the weakest, certainly.
And my thought is, maybe this is actually good, that like the Double Ds feel like they've gotten, you know, they had to do certain plot points because either the book fans wanted to see it or because George said it's important, and now they're getting to like in-game version Dorne. So it might be cool again, although, man, I don't know, maybe the Sand Snakes could be cool.
I'm not sure about that.
Yeah,
sounds like a dubious claim.
I thought they were kind of... I felt like a lot of that stuff was hokey in the books, and it is predictably hokey on the show. But
yeah,
I don't feel the same way about Ilaria. I think that she is obviously making poor decisions from a very emotionally charged place, and that's not a woman thing. Like Oberyn is kind of the same way.
Yeah,
But I do think she's interesting, and I do like her.
Yeah, and I'm interested to see how all of this political stuff shakes out.
Yeah,
more so than I'm interested in the Sand Snakes themselves.
Michael P. gets in a old lady joke. Says, "Hope Clarice Van Houten gets a makeup endorsement for this shit. Maybe she's born with it. Nah, it's definitely fucking Maybelline."
That's what's in the vials.
It's medieval Maybelline.
Okay.
Medievaline. Ephraim M. said, why the hell did Sir Alistair and gang leave the body there only to threaten Sir Davos and John's friends to kill them if they didn't give them the body? Did they go away to sleep and thought John's body is just going to still be there in the morning to pick him up after their morning latte?
It's a fair question. That's a little tough to swallow.
The only thing, and again, this is, I recognize this is hand waving. This is an out of, this is not on the screen. But judging by, it was a little bit on the screen. Judging by the way the other first, Bowen Marsh and Yarrick, the first builder and the first steward, reacted when Thorne just came out and flopped his dick out and said, yeah, I killed him there. I wonder if the plan was to have it be a bit of a mystery and kind of let the Black Brothers work through their grief before they do any kind of grand gesture. And Thorne is just, he was seeing the way this was going and wanted to kind of put the kibosh on it all. Because else, why would you leave his body there under the other thing is, I feel like that they wanted that to be staged like that because they had the big traitor sign. That wasn't for Jon Snow. That was for the people that discovered him. And maybe they fucked up because Davos found it and he was able to grab, like, if maybe they were reacting to Davos trying to rally the loyalists and they didn't have control of the spin. Like, that's what I think in my head, but I can totally forgive you if you're not following along with me because, again, it's not on the screen.
Right.
With the short runtime, maybe we could have seen a scene of Thorne before that thing where they're all talking about, oh, Jesus, we meant this to happen, and what now?
Yeah, we didn't think far enough ahead.
Yeah, like, that could have been a nice 30-second scene that would have answered those questions, and it wasn't there, so.
Yeah.
Matthew B. said, I've seen a popular internet theory that the final Melisandre scene was her giving decades of her own life so that Jon Snow could have them, instead of her being ancient, that she's essentially giving her life force up.
Okay.
Well, this seems like a reasonable idea. I'd like to... Actually, that's the first time I'd actually seen that, so...
Rapid aging?
That's kind of cool. Yeah. You know, like in the Princess Bride, like
right.
50 years of your life, what kind of sense?
Uh-huh.
I have to propose two other alternate theories on this final scene, Matthew says. A, this is just what she does every night before she goes to sleep.
Yep, sure.
There you go. That's the taking her makeup off angle. B, the scene depicts her just giving up. Her image and her youth, much like her faith, have turned out to be nothing more than illusion. The scene is her giving up the illusion and walking away from the faith. If B is true, though, there's no way she can revive Jon Snow. However, I actually think the show can go on without him. When Jon first died, I always believed he would come back to life simply because with him gone, there would be no more characters or plot lines that we would care about at the Wall. I'm happy to see I was mistaken. The plot of Davos and the few loyal brothers, a direwolf, and Ed returning with the wildlings is as captivating as a plot line at the Wall that I can think of.
Yeah.
While I'd like to see Jon return, I no longer think it's essential to the plot at the Wall.
That's fair.
I agree.
Yeah, I'm on board with Davos. Like, I don't want him to die.
I always thought Davos was cool.
I don't give a shit about those other brothers because I don't know them enough. But Davos, yeah.
Yeah.
Got to be saved.
Tall guy and shorty. I've always been fans of them.
Okay.
So the other thing is, like, I think, again, just remember what Tharo said about him losing faith and how he came to his first resurrection. This could actually be playing right into their hands. So I don't know that that's, I agree with him as far as that this means Jon Snow can't come back. Matt B. said, I was an avid book reader, and now I have this season. I'm finding this season's making me very anxious. I was actually one of the strange people who read the book first before HBO made the series. The entire time I've been able to sit back and act like I'm better than everyone because I knew where the story was going. Mm-hmm. This first episode filled me with anxiety. Is this what it's like for people who hadn't read the books? What are those people doing? This is horrible. I can't handle all these emotions. It left me wondering if I read the books just so I wouldn't watch the show in a constant state of fear. I guess my question would be, like, is this not happening to you in the books? Like, I put the books down for weeks after the Red Wedding because I'm just like, you know what? Fuck you, Martin. Fuck you. Fuck your story. I'm out. I don't want any more.
Yeah.
I came back to it, but I've had strong emotional reactions to shit that I've read in the show or in these books.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that, you know, now you're getting them. I guess that makes sense. Something like in the screen that you can see is easier to get wrapped up in than, you know, reading.
I don't know, because there's a lot of gaps and stuff that your imagination fills in that can't be portrayed as well on the screen, right? Like, I think they're both equally as vivid. I don't know that I feel like TV is a better medium. inherently.
Because I agree, because like, you can get so in your own head with the books that it's so real that the emotional connection is super strong. But on the other hand, music.
Music fucking helps.
Like, if they ever develop the ability to subliminally play some sad-ass music while you're reading a book, it might be game over. That's...
You know, we have a sponsor today that may or may not be able to do that for you.
Oh.
So...
How
I don't know why audiobooks don't do this, frankly. Because no one can read like at this.
I think it piss book readers off if they started making it more of a radio show.
And also, you can't read at the speed of TV, right? So you've got this guy reading to you paragraph after paragraph. It's a 15-minute long score for one scene.
Yeah,
it would be a nightmare.
That would be evil though if they Audible started piping in. Like sad or angry or whatever music.
Right. The Reigns of Castamere just over and over.
I would have never picked the book back up again.
Yeah.
Carlos P. says, if Melisandre is 1,000 years old, then that potentially gives her validity to the claim of being a prophetess. Okay, fair enough. Now, I don't know where he gets this 1,000 years.
She looks like it.
I think she'd look like the fucking Crypt Keeper.
She would.
Yeah, okay. If she's a legit prophet, so let's just run with that she's old.
Okay.
1,000 years, 100 years, couple hundred years, who knows? If she's a legit prophet, contrary to what Davos has been thinking, and if she's really been around for 1,000 or however many years, then wouldn't she be the main source of knowledge for White Walker lore? And if she is the most valuable source of White Walker lore, then maybe she's had a hand in everything thus far. Dragons, Bran, maybe even Winter itself. Can it be possible, being this old, that she's some sort of Gandalf type of figure? Just like Gandalf was one of the overseers of Middle-earth, maybe Melisandre is something like that to the Seven Kingdoms. If she's seen the pieces moving, like dragons and White Walkers, maybe she's been trying to prepare for all this, just like Gandalf tells Denethor to light the beacons to call for Rohan's aid. I think this is important because if she's been around for 1,000 years, then she knows what's about to happen because she's seen it happen before. I have a couple problems with this, but I want to get your perspective as a show first watcher.
Well, I mean, I don't have any indication as to exactly how old she is. Let's say she's 200 years old.
Yep.
When did the dragons leave? A couple hundred years ago, about that?
So 300 years ago, roughly, is when Aegon came over with his dragons.
Okay.
And I guess it's been about the last 100 years where the last dragon died. Viable dragon. Maybe not even that long, but those...
Right.
Also, those dragons themselves were feeble. Like almost like the size of large cats because they're so stunted and just dying off.
Right. I guess my main question would be like, what would she know that the general culture doesn't know? Because like people talk about dragons. People know that dragons existed 100 years ago, right? Is that legend that people like some people don't believe?
So there's a couple theories that the maesters and the show has done this a little bit, that the maesters might have had a hand in the dragons, like somehow secretly poisoning them because they didn't like the fact that the Targaryens were so powerful because they had these dragons and people kept getting swept up in their civil war and their family politics. And then they went on an aggressive magic isn't real campaign. And you know, that's the thing about an illiterate society, in like 2 or 3 generations, you can wipe out knowledge easy.
Sure. And with a focused effort, yeah.
Yeah, so there's this, and again, there's nothing that's hard and concrete. This is just people reading the books and having way too many years between them to speculate.
I also wonder just how much you absorb even being alive at the time. You know?
Sure.
Like, if you're not in key positions, if you're not around the action, how much firsthand knowledge do you really have of that time?
Sure, but the big thing is even if you say that she's 1,000 years old, my impression is that that's not nearly long enough to remember the White Walkers.
Right.
Like, it's been millennia. There's been 998 Lord Commanders since the Wall first got put up, and that was at the end of the Great War, so...
But who knows? They seem to drop like flies, so maybe that was 5 months ago.
It's true. It's the average lifespan of a Lord Commander once he takes the post is like 2.5 weeks.
Seems like it. I do have a question about maesters and politics. Like,
okay.
So you said they send these maesters out to all these different houses, right?
Yeah.
And all these different places. Do they actively participate in politics? Because why would they be giving everyone maesters if that were the case?
Boy, that's a loaded question, Jim.
It is? Oh,
well,
shit.
I mean, because number one, I do believe there's something in their vows that they have to serve, you know, they have to give legal service, like loyal and un, uncompromised, unbiased service to their lords, regardless of what house and regardless of their former affiliations and all that kind of thing.
So, so every house would get a maester if they're following.
That's
those
true. Every house has got a keep essentially. Like, you know, so it's not like not every hedge knight and, you know, up jumped right. whatever. Like, Bronn's not going to have a maester even if he gets his fucking castle.
Right.
Well, maybe. I don't know. I don't know how big the Stokeforths are. Anyway, on the other hand, these guys are men, and they have agendas, and there might be unofficial things that they're supposed to do. I don't know. That's what I'm saying. It's a great question, because the Citadel and the Maesters and all their order is somewhat kind of mysterious, and with Sam, both in the show and in the books, going to there to study, like, that's one of the exciting things. Like, aha!
Absolutely.
We'll actually find out what's going on in his monastic, weird political advisor order.
Yeah. I'm excited for that.
Let's move on, Stephanie R. First of all, why is Cersei suddenly so zen about the death of her children? Did she take an extra large Xanax in addition to her daily wine that morning? When Joffrey died, she was all about putting heads on spikes, everyone's, and now Jaime tells her that her bestest, purest child and only daughter is dead, and she's like, yup, nothing we can do, it's the prophecy, c'est la vie.
Well, I think the prophecy is it, right? Like, she sees this coming to fruition. She doesn't believe she can fight against it. She's devastated.
Stephanie says, I'm a much greater fan of the busting down door Cersei than this mellowed out version, but that's the thing. Like, the prideful, arrogant part of Cersei probably at this point in her life thought that she had beat the witch.
Yeah.
And in the space of God knows how much time has passed, months or very short years, all this stuff has been reversed on her. I think it's like she's looking fatalistic. Now, you might
have
not
to look
like
at her,
that look, but I think it's consistent with what a genuine human being would go through at a low point in their life.
And like, look at it through the ironic juxtaposition of her and Melisandre, right? Mm-hmm. Like, Melisandre proclaims all these prophecies, believes them to be true, and now she's seeing them not come true. Whereas Cersei always defied this prophecy and thought it wouldn't come true, and now, boom, here it is on her doorstep. Like, both of these characters are just real low right now.
Sure. Secondly, why did the traitors who killed Jon Snow not burn his body? Haven't they figured out by now that bodies aren't burned, become white walkers? Why would they just leave him in the snow? So that's a question. Why wouldn't they burn his body? I thought... Does this ring a bell to you? I thought it was established on the show that it's only if you were killed by a white or white walker. It's a kind of a zombie thing. It's not, well, zombies not in The Walking Dead. Like, if you die in this world, you do not come back as a white. It's something that the white walkers have to do to you.
Right.
So in absence of that...
I don't know.
Remember, like, the guy that came back to life at Castle Black, they'd gotten from, you know, they'd gotten his body from north of the wall.
Right.
So I'm trying to think of an example where someone whited out with no previous engagement with the White Walker.
Sure. And we know that the walkers aren't around, right?
Yeah.
They're not at the wall yet. So maybe they just didn't think there was any danger of that.
Sure. I don't know. I mean, like I said, there's the fifth thing I've been hand-waving away. Mm-hmm. Sheem says, I'm a bit confused. The old woman that told Cersei... Wait a second. Okay. Sorry. I thought I'd accidentally left a spoiler in here. It's very confusing. I have like three different documents open as I'm compiling this stuff, and it's like I'm just shutting them. Spoiler, not spoiler, spoiler, not spoiler. Mm-hmm. I'm a bit confused. The old woman, the witch, told Cersei that three of her kids would basically die. Is that prophecy fulfilled now that Joffrey, Marcella, and the unnamed baby she had with Robert all dead, or does a prophecy include Tommen and not the young baby who is also a prince? Please clear this up for me. So if you recall in season one of the ways they humanize Cersei is to have her tell the story to Catelyn about losing a young child to fever. And apparently the only actual baby she had with Robert. Yeah,
right.
Black
I'm wondering
hair
if
and,
that isn't part of it. Like, wasn't the prophecy like you would have like three children with blonde hair
gold,
and they would have shrouds of gold as well?
Was it gold in their hair, gold in their crowns, which I guess you could interpret either way.
I suppose
golden
so. I interpret it as hair, which we know all three of these do.
Well, here's
and
the
I assume a Baratheon baby wouldn't.
That scene with her and Catelyn Stark was completely a show fabrication. So they could have inadvertently opened a bit of a plot hole. But on the other hand, you could also say, well, that wasn't a gold-haired child. So
right, that's what I think. But
Yeah, but it's definitely something I could see. Them, and that's the thing. They, by evolving Cersei beyond the kind of two-dimensional cartoon villain she is in the books, they might have stepped in a bit of dragon shit there.
Frankly, how do you avoid it?
It's nearly impossible to avoid. You know, that's why the dragons had to die out.
You just end up spreading it around. It's
sure. Like, it just covers the whole land at a depth of 6 feet evenly. If that's why they had to go. TM Hughes wants to know, why does Ser Davos owe his life to Jon Snow all of a sudden? I think that might be a misinterpretation. I think Ser Davos was talking about the other dudes in the room.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Not me, but you guys kind of owe your lives. People. Yeah.
Is Gendry being entered into the Westerosi Olympic rowing team for Brazil in 2016?
Gendry? Who the fuck is Gendry again?
Gendry is the illegitimate son of Robert Baratheon that was the blacksmith that Ned rescued from the city in season one. And
Didn't he fuck off to nowhere?
Well, that's the thing. Davos put him on a boat and told him to keep rowing in this direction. And that's right. That's the joke. He's still rowing.
Okay.
He still rows to this day. Is he ever going to come back to be prominent in the show again?
I have no idea, man.
I mean, I'm perfectly fine with him just being a plot point of like, well, that's how Ned knew that, you know, the Lannister children or the Baratheon children are illegitimate.
Yeah.
But then they had him come show up with the brothers.
I have not thought about Gendry in seasons. And I don't care.
Okay.
I don't care if he comes back.
Would you recognize him if he showed back up?
Borderline.
That's all I
need. It depends.
That's all I need from you, man.
Has his hair changed? Like, did he do a Cersei or like?
Yeah, it's blonde.
A Theon. How crazy does he look?
Yeah.
Or like a Lancel.
Now, if Cersei had dyed her baby's hair blonde, could she have spared Tommen's life? That's the real question.
Well, the world may never know.
Candace W. said, when Tyrion and Varys are strolling through Meereen, the camera shows a man watching them through a broken window. The view is over a man's shoulder, but does not show his face. At this moment, Varys states that the Sons of the Harpy are so well organized that they must be taking orders from a leader. I thought the man looking out the window looks like Littlefinger. I know it bends the physics of time and space, but could Littlefinger also have had a hand in Meereen? He certainly would not be thrilled with Dany taking the Iron Throne, and he's always out to screw over Varys.
He comes back, burns the boats.
Sure, yeah.
Says, I'm here now. I'm taking over this town.
He's a boat burner.
Did it look like Littlefinger?
I...
For some reason, I kind of remember seeing a mask, but that might be a false memory.
Nah, that's the thing. Like, Littlefinger looks like an average, nondescript white guy from the back.
It's true. Yeah.
So I didn't get that, but I can also kind of squint and see where she would. But on the other hand, like, people are already giving Littlefinger grief for being the true teleporter of the Seven Kingdoms. Like, he goes, he's at the Riverlands, he's at the Vale, he's at the Winterfell, he's back down, Cersei snaps her fingers and he materializes in King's Landing. Going across a narrow sea.
That's a trip.
That's a bit of a trip.
And it's not just like, we're gonna land on the shore and here we are.
Yeah.
So you gotta go all the way down around that fucking continent, don't you?
No.
Isn't Meereen like further east than the shore?
Yes.
Than the shores of Essos?
Yeah, that's entirely true. You're okay. Right. It's not like going to Braavos. It's like going sailing down the coast of Africa almost.
So who knows?
Okay. Moving on. Lino from the Hotlanta. The ATL. Did you guys feel like the top five experiences back and forth between the Cal and his men felt like it came from a different show or movie?
Yeah.
I almost felt the actors laughing behind the acting. It seems like a bad improv moment from an Apatow movie. It was enjoyable, but out of place to me. That said, it did make me laugh. What do you think, Jim?
I agree. I thought the jokes were a little too broad for this show. Maybe a little out of place there.
Well... So, I kind of agree, but on the other hand, like, I like the fact that, like, the Cal, this is maybe the way the Cals and his blood riders talk when it's just the bros, and they don't think this white woman, this white-haired lady can understand what they're saying, so they're just, you know, like, I don't think there's any way that his loyal men would dress, you know, kind of tease him that way if they thought anyone important was paying attention.
Right.
It kind of borderline shocking they talk this way in front of his wives.
Yeah.
I wonder if this is we're supposed to imply that this is this Cal's not quite as because that's the thing. Drogo was like a capital K Cal, like he was maybe the hope to unite the whole Khalasar.
Yeah, I broadly felt the same way about Tyrion jabbing at Varys. Like, because you aren't a boy, because you have no cock. Like, good goof, Tyrion, but a little mean-spirited and not really I don't know, it's within his character. They have a antagonistic relationship.
They do a little bit, but that's not their finest work.
Not at all, no.
Okay. So. Moving on, Logan C. said, 2 points I'd like to ask you guys about. First, I know you guys touched on the inconsistent Game of Thrones time stream in the instant cast, but I've long wondered why Thrones can get away with this, whereas shows like Breaking Bad or others cannot. It doesn't impact my appreciation of the show, but it's odd that Thrones gets a pass here, where we may kill another show if it did the same thing.
Well, the places where we kill shows like The Walking Dead on this topic are when there's other continuity to say this should have happened like this, and it's an actual continuity error. Whereas this is a shifting timeline that is confusing, but I think consistent. Like, I don't think there's, like, big things that say, well, this must have happened here, and this must have happened here, and they couldn't be the same time, but the show is acting like they're the same time.
Yeah.
It doesn't ever do that. It's just showing us different chunks of time.
And also, like, I give him a pass because I mean, they're kind of screwed with the kids aging, because that tells you years are passing. Yeah. But in the books, it's not like that. But like, you're never going to hear me slam The Walking Dead because Chandler Riggs is now 17 years old.
Sure.
Like, that's a consequence of being on the air for 7-8 years.
We might make jokes about it, but
I make jokes, but and I can't criticize him when they give him material that was appropriate for when he was an 8-year-old, like in the comics.
Yeah.
But that's the thing, like, and I guess that's the Bran question, when Bran's this hulking, you know, man. Arya and Sansa can still pull off they don't feel like they've aged.
As much, certainly.
And Jon Snow doesn't either, because they were, it's kind of amazing. They actually got really lucky with Arya. Because
I think so.
She was really young, and she could have turned into, she could have pulled like a Hermione Granger and like completely transformed. But she still kind of believably plays a very young girl.
Yeah, I think so.
If you told me that Maisie Williams was 13, 14, I wouldn't be like, get the fuck out of here.
Here's the other thing.
She's 18, 19 now.
The other thing with this show.
So I read some horrifying thing. She's got a sex scene in some movie, and I'm like, what the fuck?
Right. Arya.
Yeah.
Arya, you've lost all your innocence.
Yeah. Stabbing a man's eyes out and cutting his throat. Yeah. Sex scenes, what's going on?
Well, you participate in both violence and...
Sure. Well, I'm an American, okay? I'm much more comfortable with graphic violence and graphic sex, okay?
Absolutely. And we know nothing about the Queen. the other thing about this show and this universe is that the distances are vast.
Yes.
And travel is fucking boring.
Yes.
And you never want to see those kind of connecting moments, right? Unless it's Varys and Tyrion riding through the countryside, cracking each other with jokes.
And that's the they get away with that for the fantasy stuff. Because, like, same with Star Wars. Like, oh, we're at Tatooine. Now we're at the core of the galaxy. Now we're outside the galaxy.
Certainly.
I mean, like, do you really want for them?
How many parsecs do you want to see?
Exactly.
Come on.
I think that's why they get away with it, because it's the ambition that you got, it's supposed to be taking place within a year or so, but the kids are visually aging, and what are you going to do?
Yeah.
You know, recast the kids? I don't think so. And also the fantasy just kind of makes it a little bit... It's like adding alcohol to, you can drink a Coke or you can drink a rum and Coke. Your evening's going to go a lot different if you go with the rum and Coke, and that's what fantasy does for you.
Yep.
Secondly, I'm a little tired of the same old story with Danny, Logan continues. Sure, this most recent rendezvous with the Dothraki may lead to something big for her in terms of gaining support, but she does seem to be constantly trudging through Essos with no clear return to Westeros in sight for her. Aeron seemed to be enjoying her arc as of now, but I'm tired of it. Will she ever return? The happenings in Westeros move so quickly, there's constant turnover there. Essos seems to just slow down what should be an integral storyline, that storyline being Dany, the dragons, and Tyrion. Your thoughts?
I have been variably bored and excited by Dany's plot over the years, by Dany's role in all this.
I think that sums up a lot of people's feelings.
Yeah, it's hitting a bit of a lull right now. I don't know that I care to see Dany off doing her thing. I'd much rather see her back in Meereen with Tyrion.
Yeah,
trying to conquer this problem
that
they've got. But I guess I have faith that it'll come back around to something more interesting than just Jorah and Daario ride in and save the day, and then they all go back to Meereen, and this was a big delay.
Right. Yeah, something, I mean, that's the thing is, Once that I was much more patient once they got the Marine, because that's something for Danny to do.
Right.
When Danny was just going around the beggar queen trying to figure out and where's my drag, that got old quick. But now, because I feel like that's the thing, like I would actually find it incredibly unsatisfying if someone rode up with 100 chips right now and be like, let's fuck off to Westeros, because she needs to deal with Marine. They've made this as like, this is her Waterloo. She's either going to figure out how to rule the city, and, yeah. and it's important to her. And, like, she was a slave herself with no agency, and she does not want, like, it's not good enough to kick over the Hornet's Nest and then leave. She wants to set up something that's enduring.
And as much as Arya is being trained right now, Dany is being trained.
Yes.
I mean, she... if she's to take over King's Landing and rule, she can't have no experience with a kingdom that large. So ruling the city of Meereen and getting a handle on that is important both to her because of all the motivation she has, but also to the story where she becomes an actual ruler.
Now, having said that, knowing what the Double D's have said recently with there being perhaps 13 more episodes of plot left...
For Danny, or
for the entire after this season.
Oh, after this, okay.
So
right,
you got 10 more. Everyone, calm down. You got 9 more episodes, and then another 7.
Okay, and then another. 6.
Oh no, sorry, another 13.
Yeah,
another 3. A -5. -5 episodes.
Everyone is confused.
So you got after this season, you got 13 episodes left.
Yeah.
It's going to be somewhat shocking if she's not poised to take on Westeros at the end of this season. Like take heart, people. Like, yeah. if she doesn't leave Westeros here, it's probably, or she doesn't leave for Westeros here, it's probably because she's in a box.
Okay.
Which, I mean, maybe not take heart, but
a weirwood box? Is it like?
Sure. Yeah, and she'll get resurrected.
Although
they'd
have to import that wood, wouldn't it? I guess, you know, imported wood's more expensive.
They got a free trade agreement with Essos. It's the import's not going to be a problem. I think that the thing's going to be moving quickly. But that's been a joke with us book readers, because we know that she just sits a Marine and does nothing for ever. Like, every season, people are like, oh my god, Dany's got her ship, she's going. I'm like, yeah, wait, just keep... Now I think the joke's on everyone.
Right.
Because, man, if she doesn't make it out this season, what the hell? Speaking of disagreements with Danny's plot, 20 Minutes wrote in and said, the Double D's idea of an interesting subplot for the Queen of Dragons to have her get kidnapped again and sit through 20 minutes of catcalling? Why? Seriously, out of all the interesting things that could be going on for her, we have to go back to the basic of the rapey kidnap? Daenerys spent countless episodes clawing her way up, and now all that progress is stripped away from her. Not only that, but why? I swear the Double D's have some kind of weird rape obsession, because they do their best to fit it into the plot lines of every single female character in some shape or form.
You know what? I bet that was a part of every single female's life during those times.
Don't kid yourself. It's still a big fear for women today.
Absolutely.
In the case of Daenerys, sexual violence and threats of sexual violence are more the bread and butter of her character arc than her goddamn dragons. Okay. Now, obviously, I've spent a lot of time talking about this particular subject, and as I explained briefly in my show discussion, I felt like the fundamental difference here, even from Sansa, is that Daenerys knows more than these people do, and she's got the trump card of her, she's the mother of dragons, she's got dragons, and she's got one particular that's roaming the countryside and still feels some kind of loyalty towards her,
right,
and protectiveness towards her. And she knows the Dothraki culture. She knows she has this. So it's like the whole time they're yucking about what they're going to do to her, and they don't think she's understanding. She's gaining information, engaging the situation, know that she can deal this card off the top of the deck and win. Or at least do something with it. And I feel like that it's premature to judge this plot line until we see what happens with her when she gets to Vaas Dothrak. But you're not... I understand why people would be sensitive to this kind of shit looking like it's starting up again.
Well, I think that's key. They might almost, in a way, be getting a preemptive start toward where Dany's going.
Yeah.
Like, if she were in Meereen at this point and the boats were burning and she weren't yet on her way to finding what I think is a crucial piece of an army that she doesn't quite have yet.
Yeah.
Like, she has dragons. She has a few thousand Unsullied, if that, now. But I don't think that's enough to take King's Landing. I don't think you
she
can
still
do
doesn't have yeah you're right she so, still doesn't have enough.
So if this is a way for her to get a Dothraki army,
which
I
is,
think they're getting a jump start on that by having the boats burn while she's out already.
And see, that's the thing, like Khal Drogo, she was getting the shit renovated. Like, this is all someone else's stuff who feels sorry for you, and now she built this shit from the ground up. And that means, like, yes, it's like a return to the same plot that we got in season one, but her characters change and what her ownership of the situation has changed.
Yeah. I'm...
But no, the fact that women got raped in the past, so I don't find that a persuasive reason to have it in every, because, like, you know what else?
Oh, sure, yeah.
Men stubbed their toes when they're 25 and got their feet amputated, and they got hernias, and that shit never comes up in fights, so it's like, if we want to talk historical accuracy, right. But I think they're going for, I would take hope and say they're going for something a little bit more interesting this time, 20 minutes.
I hope so, but I can still totally see why. This would be pretty boring.
Yeah.
For a lot of people.
Yep. Sparky Z said, the wildlings wipe out the knights. Oh, wait. This is... I introduced this poorly. Has some speculation for what he thinks is going to happen based on some of the stuff we said in the preview. He thinks the wildlings going to wipe out the Night's Watch entirely and garrison the wall. Who better to make a determined stand against the White Walkers than people who had seen what the Army of the Dead can do? Mm. The Night's Watch was a failing or perhaps failed institution with no support from Westeros and no prospects of being able to fully garrison the wall. Most of the members of the Watch don't really believe in Grumpkins and Snarks beyond the wall. The Watch was never going to work hand-to-hand with the Wildlings. It's a pathway to citizenship for the Wildlings. With the abolition of the Watch, Jon can legitimately ignore those pesky vows way better than the technicality of now his Watch has ended loophole nonsense. So this is essentially him saying that, like, instead of the Watch is being destroyed and taken up by the Wildlings, I think that's kind of an interesting idea.
I suppose so. Yeah. They have a much larger army at this point.
Yeah. They do a better job than the few hundred. I mean, at this point, when they said 40 men, because at one point, I think it's Davos said, a dire wolf is not going, or no, they said, what's a redhead going to do against 40 armed men?
Right.
I think that's an accurate estimation of the Black Brothers' total strength now.
At Castle Black?
At, well, yeah, there might be some other.
I think it's
yeah,
at Castle
true.
Black, because we know still. They were going to send what's-his-nuts who got his head chopped off over to another castle. Yeah. And
they've always garrisoned Eastwatch by the sea. And
I have a feeling the shit's going to go down at Castle Black. Like, I don't
You got 40 guys plus, what, half a dozen in a room and a dire wolf?
Yeah.
Like, and...
Well, what I mean is, like, when the White Walkers come to the wall, they're going to approach from Castle Black. I don't think we're going to jump over to some other castle on the wall with a bunch of nobodies we've never seen and the White Walkers sneak through that way.
Fair enough.
So...
Wynn has a related a thought here. Said when Dolorous Ed is dispatched to recruit the others that owe their life to Jon Snow, I thought Davos meant the Wildlings, which I believe you pointed out as well. Now if Ed comes back with a band of Wildling fighters and they liberate the Loyalists or otherwise fight the remaining Night's Watch brothers, Alistair Thorne's prediction will have come true. He's been saying all along that not to let these murderous rapists through the gates because they will turn around and become enemies to the Night's Watch. Obviously, the circumstances are a little different than everyone expected, but this is a roundabout way of proving that Alistair was, in fact, correct. Just thought this was a noteworthy observation. I think
now, combine this with the email before.
I think the irony is even higher, that Alistair created a self-fulfilling prophecy through his actions and stubbornness.
Right, because if he doesn't kill Jon Snow, this Watch is not destroyed. Yeah.
Right, right. But because of his stubborn way of clinging to what he thought the mission of that's I've always been more sympathetic to John. Like, I'm fighting for the side of the living.
Me too, yeah.
And, like, it's all well and good to keep the wildlings out from raping and reaving and whatever they're doing. But, like, when it's us against an undead army, you gotta side with the living.
Yeah. This is why making promises always backfires, right? These vows, like,
sure.
Circumstances change, man, and we might have to do something that we didn't expect. 1,000 years ago when we took up this vow.
Well, and that's one of the great, interesting, rich things about Game of Thrones is it explores the guys like Ned who are so stuck on their loyalty and their word that they do stupid shit and get defeated by evil men, and guys like Littlefinger whose words mean nothing.
Right.
Like, there's a middle ground here that I think is best embodied by Dany and Jon, where they're like, you know what?
Mm-hmm.
This is a lot more complicated situation than everyone's trying to make it. We need to understand and figure this shit out and be smart about it. And, of course, one of them's dead and the other one's being kidnapped. So it's still a Martin production. William I says, the way for Jon Snow to return will be to copy of what happened to Jon Locke and Lost.
Oh, God. Okay.
After Locke, yeah, you're going to have to help me out because I know
that. So he's
going to
come back
as a smoke monster.
Spoiler alert. Lost. No, he's not coming back as a smoke monster. He's coming back as some spiritual island protector. I don't fucking know.
But he actually asserts that he was brought back as a smoke monster taking his form.
He was brought back as Jacob.
Okay,
I don't know. There's shit in a cave. Like, that show lost me at that point.
Okay,
like,
so
big time.
All the lost bands discuss with William amongst yourself.
Yeah,
he says it's so simultaneously true that the Locke was really dead, yet he still had some kind of form that lived on, and he wonders if Jon Snow's going to be like, we're all expecting him to be Lord of Lighted or Whited or what if he comes back as more of either, you know, the meat puppet theory that's going to be manipulated by whatever's keeping Melisandre alive, or what if he comes back as almost like a ghost or a force, or, you know, he's in the trees, he's in the wolves, he's in all of
trees.
Us. Like,
oh, God. This is where the fantasy stuff loses
me. I don't know.
Can I just say real quick?
No.
For your sake, okay. Aaron. Please, I know, I'm admitting it. I'm wrong, and you're right about Lost. Please, we don't need Lost emails on top of the Game of Thrones emails. Just don't do it. Keyboards down.
All right.
You're right.
I'm making an email filter right now.
Lost, exclude,
direct to trash. Yeah, because that's the thing. Like, I thought you had seen up until the last season.
I have,
like,
but
you
man,
did a lot of background
show.
Watching in the last few seasons.
Yeah.
Jane W. says, does it bother you guys that the graffiti in Marine is in modern English? There's something that feels just really jarring to me about this visual, almost as if we accidentally got a glimpse of camera equipment in the shot. Of course, not only do the Marines, Marinese obviously not speak the common tongue, but I've always thought the common tongue was something closer to Anglo-Saxon or something, or the language we know of as English not yet existing. And also, wouldn't the slaves be illiterate for the most part? What do you think?
Sure. Like, I guess if that bothers you, I understand why, but
I just feel
to
like
me, I don't care.
Star Wars, man. Like, every time you see written Star Wars, it's all some kind of weird Star Wars glyphy conj crap. Mm-hmm. But when you got to know that Obi-Wan's shutting down the shield generators, they're labeled with red tape, shield generator.
Right.
You know, sometimes you got to cheat so the people at home, you know, I guess it felt more real if it's some kind of crazy font. And then it has a subtitles that say,
right. I mean, they could have had, you know, they could have done the goof where Tyrion's like misreading it or something.
Yeah.
Like as they walk by and Varys is like, no, it says this.
I guess that could have been, yeah.
I mean, it would have been pretty easy to do that.
Yeah.
So shame on them for not doing it, but I don't care personally.
And also the fact that the slaves are illiterate, that's true, but people, you know, I mean, that could actually be an implication that,
that someone else wrote it?
Yeah. Like, here's my thought. Grey Worm and his commandos are the ones that originally wrote Kill the Masters. And then the Sons of the Harpy, whatever faction they are, wrote Misha is a master. So, like,
right.
I don't think it's the slaves doing the writing.
Hmm.
But whether English or not bothers you, I mean, that's just...
If it really bothers you, go to Reddit. Somebody corrected it.
So. They put it in the original Valyrian?
Yeah.
Yeah. With proper grammar and everything.
Uh-huh.
But they said something about the Misha wants to eat us. I don't know. Teresa V says, why do you think they spent so much time reminding us about the grayscale? This is the last email, by the way. They highlighted it on the previously on, which was insanely long, and then took time to show Jorah looking at his grayscale again. We get it. Jorah's dying. Why do you guys think they need to keep reminding us?
They are really just bashing us over the head with this stuff. I mean, from actually showing his wrist with the grayscale to all of the dialogue in that scene. Like, if you live long enough, I hope I live long enough to see Dany conquer it. Oh, yeah, me too. Well, we know Jorah's not going to. I mean, he's got, what, 6 months if he's lucky, and then he's headed to Valyria.
I think it's when we'll swallow it, so when he gets fully grayscaled, he becomes like the Thing from Fantastic Four, and it's all about clobbering time.
God.
But he
says clobbering time in Valyrian, right?
Yes, of course. You'd have to be in High Valyrian.
Right. It's probably like...
Forsooth, it's thy time for clobbering. I don't know, because I could see if they went 4 or 5 episodes that mention it, people would be like, oh, they've really lost a grayscale plot. It's just, you know, you got to always remember, the people listening to this podcast, we are the 1%.
Right.
Most people, they're like, I fucking love Game of Thrones, and I'm excited for it to watch, and they're posting memes on Facebook and shit, are like, they need the previously ons.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is, like, when you're binge-watching these in the future, these previously ons won't exist.
That's
so
true.
Like, yeah. It could be that you're just peaked, your ire is peaked because you got the 4-minute intro where they belabored the point, and then they belabor it within 5 minutes or 15 minutes of getting into the episode. I don't know that that's their fault. That's just that's just the way this stuff works in the previously ons, and sometimes it doesn't work in your favor.
Yeah, I mean, it is. It's pretty obvious at this point.
But also, I don't know. Do you want to speculate about where they're going with this grayscale stuff?
I mean, there's no actual cure. I mean, I guess there kind of is. Well, if you're Stannis.
Shireen went into remission.
Right. I mean, it didn't go away, but it didn't kill her. Yeah. Or it didn't make her into whatever the Valyrian city has become.
The Doomed Men. Yeah. The Stone Men, rather.
Right. So I guess there is some kind of treatment for it, but he seems to be just on a mission to rescue Dany, his health be damned. I don't know that he's out trying to cure himself.
Do you think there'll be this petty plot where he deliberately infects Daario?
No, that doesn't seem like Jorah.
Jorah's done a lot of things that don't seem like Jorah.
The only way I could see that is if he thought that Daario wasn't actually trying to help Dany,
but
and was in some way working against her.
That's the thing. Like, it's in the Game of Thrones universe, it's entirely possible that Daario could legitimately be 100% for the queen and for Jorah to suspect otherwise.
Maybe so.
And that would be like another tragedy to his character.
They haven't set that up yet, but I mean, if they do go that direction, sure, then I could see it.
At this point, though, another popular theory is that I've seen is that Jorah is going to accidentally infect the whole of Meereen. But at this point, if one more goddamn thing happens, Meereen, that's not moving Dany closer to getting the fuck out of there, I think people will riot.
Yeah.
Like, if, you know, episode 8, it's like, we're about ready to get on the boats. Oh, shit, my people are, struck with the plague. I cannot leave them,
Yeah.
Good God, can you imagine the feedback we'll get on that?
What if he sullies the Unsullied accidentally? And there goes our army.
They grow stone penises. They replace their lost limbs. And that's how Grey Worm and Missandei are going to get together. He's going to have a brand new stone penis and balls. All this romance plot was going somewhere.
Imagine if you had an army of Unsullied who were also stone men. That she could somehow control. And dragons, and the Dothraki. That's a pretty formidable army.
That's actually kind of cool, because the whole thing about the Unsullied are so disciplined, and they take those drugs, so they're not susceptible to pain. Like, it'd be interesting if they got all of the physical strength, or, I guess, tough skin, but none of the, they're still able to follow orders.
Yeah, the infectious zombie-like quality, too.
Yeah, because that's kind of what they were trained from birth to do, to be and do with different,
just obey and fight.
Yeah, so that's maybe, still is an instinct that they retain.
I'm going crazy with speculation here.
That's what we love.
But why not?
Speaking of going crazy speculation, we will have a spoiler edition of our podcast out on Friday. Can't promise on any. People have sent me some intriguing tinfoils that I'm researching right now.
Okay.
So we might have more than I thought this season. Definitely not one this week, but we will have a good hardcore spoiler speculation. I've already gotten a lot of email, but it's not too late. GameofThrones@baldmove.com. If you get it to me before Thursday morning, it's probably going to be the cutoff, because I have to eventually say enough and produce the episode. But so you got a day or two to get this into me and make the spoiler edition at long last. We did 2 hours on the first damn episode where nothing really happened. I'm afraid, Jim.
It could be bad.
We'll always be podcasting.
Maybe this is just the initial excitement and it'll wear off, but
That's never been the case.
It's true.
It always starts off with, oh my God, I can't believe there's this much feedback coming in. And then the end of the season is like,
Right. So you get hit with dragon shit.
We'll see. I need to contract grayscale.
All right, that's it. Thanks, everybody, for sticking with us for such a long episode. And if you're into spoilers, we'll see you Friday. If not, we'll see you right after the episode on Sunday. And until then, I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron. See ya.